I've been inspecting the chair. So that when members walk in, the place is secure. Can I ask members to take their seats? Good morning. As indicated, we had agreed that even though we had planned not to have hearings on the medium-term budget policy statement, but after we realized that at the insistence of the Joint Budget Committee, there was time allowed for this process, we therefore felt that it would not be proper to deprive people an opportunity to comment on this medium-term budget policy statement. And we want to thank the people that have availed themselves, Mr. Jacques Lobsham, Group Economist Sanlam, Mr. Ghulam Balim, Standard Bank Chief Economist, and Mr. Davirod, to have availed themselves short notice. It really is appreciated. We will be giving each one of you 20 minutes to address us, and then we will take a discussion on all three of your presentations. I'm going to request that members make note of their questions as presenters make their presentation. Without wasting time, we've already wasted adequate time. I'm going to ask Mr. Jacques Lobsham to address us. You have 20 minutes, Mr. Lobsham. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've entitled my talk to you this morning, An Exercise in the Art of the Possible, because I think at the moment nobody, including the fiscus, is actually in a position to be able to do exactly what they would want to do. We live in extraordinary times, which are times in which economic history is being made, which can be interesting, but it can be, I must admit, quite tiring also at times. And that's the background against which, of course, this medium-term budget policy statement was delivered. Now, of course, the overwhelming influence in the world economy at the moment is the international financial crisis that took on a new momentum since mid-September after Lehman Brothers folded. I think we're getting to a point where perhaps the financial system is being stabilized. I think the relevant authorities and the regulators and so on have realized that it's a systemic problem, and a systemic problem requires a systemic solution. And that is what's been put in place now step by step in the past couple of weeks. There are tentative signs of stabilization. As I said, the interbank money markets globally look like it's slowly starting to unfreeze, but it will take a long time before we get back to normal activity in the financial system. And I think it's also quite clear that the financial system needs to be reformed, and that's a process that will take quite a few years to complete this initial thoughts on the table. But there's still a lot of discussion that needs to take place. I just want to plead for some balance in this debate, and perhaps in your own thoughts regarding this matter. I really think this is a time that one should be very careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's become very fashionable in recent times to say, yes, but the whole problem is just greed in the financial sector, and that the solution is therefore much bigger government involvement in that sector. The way I would want to put it is I think the underlying cause is human failure. And it's human failure amongst business people, but also human failure amongst the regulators, and also human failure at the political level. And you don't avoid or eliminate human failure by just changing the system. Humans will always be humans. Just if you will just bear with me for a few thoughts on this matter. As I said, it's fashionable to say it's the greed in the financial sector amongst the participants there that caused the problem. I want to read you three sentences from a report that came to my attention last week. It's a report from the New York Times, and please note the date, September the 30th, 1999. The heading is Fannie Mae Eases Credit to Aid Mortgage Lending. And the report is about Fannie Mae, the nation's biggest underwriter of home mortgage, that's now the U.S., and Fannie Mae, as you all know, since been nationalized, has been under increasing pressure from the Clinton administration to expand mortgage loans among low and moderate income people. Fannie Mae does not lend money directly to consumers. Instead, it purchases loans that banks make on what is called the secondary market. By expanding the type of loans that it will buy, Fannie Mae is hoping to spur banks to make more loans to people with less than stellar credit ratings. And the report says, with remarkable foresight, in moving even tentatively into this new area of lending, Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk, which may not pose difficulties during flush economic times. But the government-subsidized corporation may run into trouble in an economic downturn, prompting a government rescue. Now, that was 1999. So it seems as though this whole event that we've seen could, I think in reasonably we said, could have been avoided. It's not as if we just sort of ran into this brick wall unknowingly. It's, as I said, fashionable to say that we must get more government involvement in the sector. But I just want to draw your attention to a report that came out only a few weeks ago about systemic banking crises. And according to that report, there was 124 such crises between 1970 and 2007 in the world. This is not the first one at all. It's by far the largest, of course. But the observation in this report was that government ownership of banks is common in crisis countries, with the government owning about 31% of banking assets on average. In many cases, government ownership may have become a vulnerability, as problems at state-owned banks have been major contributors to the cost and unfolding of the crisis, with many exhibiting low asset quality prior to the onset of a crisis. If you look at these crises and the type of economic systems in which they occurred, it's not only in sort of laissez-faire Anglo-Saxon type of economic systems. They also occurred in the early 90s in the social democratic countries of Scandinavia. In the 1990s, they also occurred in the developmental states, countries of Asia, starting with Japan, which is the original developmental state where the whole concept actually comes from. South Korea also comes to mind. And even at this point in time, again, South Korea is one of the countries that's being worst hit. One can even refer to China. Apparent calm there, but don't forget that China struggled with a huge problem of non-performing loans for a long time. Between 1990 and 2002, 50% of their loans, that's from state-owned banks, became non-performing. They had to write it off at the cost of 47% of GDP. At the end of 2005, the outstanding stock of non-performing loans was estimated still to be 25% of GDP. So we need reform of the financial system, but I just want to make the point and I want to make the plea that one should just maintain balance in this whole discussion and in this whole argument, that the solutions that's being put forward are not foolproof. They also have their shortcomings. It struck me, by the way, earlier this week, I saw a report in the Financial Times that said in the UK, with the British government now having large stakes in the big banks in the UK, and they will be getting board presentation, now is the opportunity for the government then to instruct the banks to lend to specific industries. Now, that's only a short step from starting to instruct them in also to lend to specific businesses. And to my mind, that's an orange light that flashes. But fact of the matter is that the real economy is the next phase in unfolding phase in this whole crisis. I think we can take it for granted recession is on its way. The developed countries, many of them will experience recession in the classical sense of two consecutive quarters at least of negative economic growth. The developing and emerging market countries, I think there it will be more a matter of growth recessions. In other words, still positive growth, but much lower than in previous years. I think it's fair to say that if you were to add together the contribution to the world economy of the countries that will be going most likely into recession, they will account for roughly 60% of the world economy. The big question at the moment is how severe will this recession be and how long will it last? And quite frankly, I don't think there's anybody in the world that can claim to know exactly what the answers to those questions actually are, especially regarding how severe it will be. I can, with more confidence, predict that I think it will be a prolonged recession because of the long process of adjustment that needs to take place in the financial sector. But how deep the recession will be is at this moment, point in time, I think is anybody's guess. What you see up there on the screen is the latest forecast from the IMF. That's also in the medium-term budget policy statement published there. And you can see, if you look at those dark blue columns, that's for the developed world, quite a severe downturn. On a calendar base, calendar year basis, they still forecast positive growth for the emerging and developing countries, a growth slowdown, as I said earlier on. But of course, what the calendar numbers mask is the fact that in the meantime, if you look at it on a quarter-by-quarter basis, then we're going to have two or three or perhaps four quarters until middle of next year at least, when things are going to be much tougher even than what that graph tends to tell you. Just to look at a few indicators, the OEC leading indicator, and the OECD still accounts for roughly three-quarters of the world economy. Compared to growth, you can see that leading indicator in negative territory, indicating that the evidence that we have so far on growth doesn't fully reflect yet the worsening in conditions. So on that basis, one must expect things in the short term to get worse. And then from a South African perspective specifically, if you take that leading indicator together with the trend in commodity prices, with us, of course, being a big commodity exporter, there you can see there's still a huge gap there. It looks even from that graph as though commodity prices still has to have to plunge quite substantially before they can go bottom. But just to qualify that, I think one must bear in mind what that graph also shows you perhaps is that specifically as far as commodity markets are concerned, the OECD has become less relevant in recent years because of the rise of China, for example. That's not who's not a member of the OECD, is not included there. And therefore, it's so important to us that countries such as China, although they also will have growth slowdowns, as was reported earlier this week, that they must still maintain fairly high growth rates to support the commodity markets, both in terms of price and in terms of volumes to support our exports. Because our Achilles heel is the current account deficit. I think by now perhaps you must be getting a bit bored about talking all the time just about the current account deficit, but the reality is that this is an enormous challenge to the South African economy. You will note from the medium-term budget policy statement forecast that the current account deficit is predicted to be to remain at around about 8 to even close to 9% of GDP over the next couple of years, which poses a huge financing challenge to us. Now, if you look at the composition of the current account deficit, I think those are quite interesting numbers. Many people equate the current account with a trade account, and they see the current account deficit then as a trade deficit. But as you can see from those numbers, is once again, they come from the medium-term budget policy statement, the the single biggest contributor is actually the net income receipts. In other words, the amount that we pay out more in dividends and interest to foreigners than what we ourselves receive back from overseas on our own investments that we hold, hold elsewhere. The trade balance is only roughly about a quarter of the total deficit. Debt service receipts also quite a negative, and then you see there also the transfers to the custom union countries that's responsible for about 1% of GDP in terms of the deficit. And the biggest deterioration you can see since from 2004 till the first half of this year took place in the trade balance and also then in the net income receipts. So if you want to address the current account deficit and you want to address it only through the trade account, you're facing an enormous challenge to bring that deficit down. The adjustment that we've seen in the rand exchange rate will help automatically I think, improve the trade balance by making exports cheaper and imports more expensive. It will likewise have an impact on the net service payments. That's for things like transport and insurance and so on. So if trade volumes drop, those will also come down. But the net income receipts will, I think, although the dividend outflows will definitely also decline, but that will be quite challenging to reduce that part of the current account deficit. If you look at the composition of the capital inflow that must cover that deficit, in recent years, portfolio investment, you can see there, first numbers there just for 2003 and 4, and then jumping to 2007 and the first half of this year. But in recent years, since 2004 up to 2007, portfolio investment was the single biggest contributor to our inflows. First half of this year, direct investment, the single biggest component of that, but because of one transaction. That was the Chinese buying into Standard Bank that gave us that increase. What is making it very difficult to get a grip on the risk to our capital flows is unfortunately the fact that such a large part of our capital flows, we don't really have much information what's going on there. The unrecorded transactions, for example, that's been quite large at times. The other investment component that is also a bit vague. There are questions about carry trade and all those kind of things. But still, you can't get away from it that that it poses a big risk. And at this point, it's difficult to see how we can maintain a current account deficit of around 8% of GDP for the next few years against the global background that we have. The most up-to-date information that we have on capital flows are those for foreign portfolio investment. And there you can see, if you look there on the right-hand side of the graph, the outflow from portfolio disinvestment in October so far is by far the biggest number in history. So we're facing severe challenges there. And therefore, as the next slide will show, the rand is under enormous pressure. I'm showing the rand just against the three major currencies, the dollar, the euro, and the pound. They're all based to 100 there in 2001, so you can see we depreciated over that period the most, actually, against the euro, although the dollar is recently the one where the focus has been. But to understand that, it's not only a South African matter. We've caught up in a global frenzy. The following graph will show you there the relationship recently between the rand and the so-called VIX. Now, the VIX is a volatility index that's based on the Standard & Poor's 500 equity index in the U.S. So that jump in the VIX, the blue line there, shows you how market volatility has increased. It's often used as a proxy for risk aversion in markets. So when that line increases, that index, it tells you that risk aversion is increasing. And you can see that, as I said, we are caught up in an international frenzy where I think there's just a withdrawal from all risky assets. Investors in the developed world are withdrawing money from emerging markets as an asset class, and we are part of that asset class, so it's not as if they are singling us out. We are part of that asset class, and we are being caught up in that. The next graph,
Can I just indicate to members that we seem to have a problem with the hard copies because they're made in black and white, and they do not reflect the other lighter colors on the two graphs. So I'm going to request that Bradley at least is able to get hold of a color printer to be able at least to make those slides available to members. Our apologies for Parliament's...
But on the screen it
on
will
the
be...
Screen, on the screen, yes, there. It's there, but it's mostly when you look at the... because members will take with themselves these, and they won't understand what... Okay, go ahead.
But on that slide, yesterday afternoon, as I was finalizing this presentation, I just looked at the Reuters screen there on my desk, and at the currency headlines, sterling hits multi-year lows, Central European FX foreign exchange pressure, Hungarian foreign touches new lows, Norway finance minister says crisis pulled out its crown, Brazil 6% down, Mexican peso loses 4.9% before official opening, Turkish lira weakens, Romanian view down 2.5%, Asian foreign exchange plumps multi-year lows. So it's a storm, it's a global storm that we are in which we have been caught up. The big question forward, of course, is we don't know where this rand will settle. Fortunately, it retraced a little bit since late yesterday afternoon. But, of course, it means additional inflationary risk. Compared to the inflation that we had, the rise in inflation in 2002, when after the late 2001 weakening in the currency, we are fortunate that this time at least there are countervailing forces. At least we have oil prices coming down and other commodity prices also coming down. So at least we get some relief on food inflation and fuel inflation. We also have in view the revision of the basket, CPI basket, that will take place in January next year that will reduce our inflation rate by roughly about 2 percentage points. So those things will help, but the weak rand certainly puts broader pressures on inflation. And I think the Reserve Bank at the moment must be holding their breath. It's early days. The consensus has been until a week ago, I would say, that interest rates have peaked, and I would also have said that. Now it's starting to become a question whether interest rates have indeed peaked. Personally, I must say that I think the chances are that perhaps we will not see inflation rising much further beyond the current already quite high levels, but it can remain at these high levels for a longer period than what we've forecast previously. So this question will be unanswered, I think, for some time still, whether interest rates have indeed peaked. Just referring back to what I said earlier on, if we want through the trade account and through suppressing imports in particular to improve the current account balance, we're either going to need a hefty increase in interest rates, or the unfortunate reality is we will have to slow our infrastructure development program because of its fairly high, part of it at least, has a fairly high imported content in terms of foreign equipment and machinery and stuff that that we need to import. The fact of the matter is, the next slide please, that the economy is already very weak. That just shows you car sales and retail sales. Retail sales in particular, the last number was in real terms 5.5% lower than a year ago. Car sales, number of units, is 20-30% lower than a year ago. So how much more do you want to suppress this economy to get imports down? We're really in the fix here. So I think we must also look, to my mind, more imaginatively at the finance side. And the medium-term budget policy statement does refer to the fact that it's becoming more expensive to borrow offshore. The graph shows you our own long-term bond yield, but it also shows you the blue line. the international benchmark, that is the U.S. long-term bond yield, as a risk-free measure. You might argue and say, but is that correct to call that risk-free? But nevertheless, that's the practice, that's the market practice, plus the emerging market risk premium. And we actually held up quite well against that change in economic conditions in terms of our domestic market until recently. But it will be more expensive, certainly, to get money from offshore. I agree with the National Treasury that borrowing requirement of about 3% of GDP is financeable for us domestically. But that would still leave us with the challenge to buy dollars to finance, for example, the power stations that Eskom, all that equipment that they will have to import, payments to foreign contractors that will also come in to do part of the work. So I would say I don't see anything in the medium-term budget policy statement about it, that, but we should be pragmatic and seriously consider other sources of infrastructure finance, and I'm referring, for example, to the World Bank. And I'm inclined to think that we'll be able to get that on a bit on better terms than in the open market. So I would actually like to know whether perhaps there in the background we are preparing ourselves for such an event. Just to finalize, the medium-term budget policy statement identifies two views: a deep global recession or a medium-term adjustment that has a fairly benign outcome. The budget is based on the second, the more optimistic scenario. Therefore, one must, I think, be aware that the risk is to the downside and not to the other side. In particular, second and third year out, I think those numbers at this stage are very, very tentative. The growth projections from the medium-term budget policy statement, compared to our own forecast, it looks a bit optimistic to us. We think growth this year will be between 3 and 3.5, and next year between 2 and 2.5, for example. The inflation forecast is dependent on very much on what happens to the rand. And then, as I said, that current account deficit, difficult to see how we can maintain that. So, therefore, the changes to the budget, I'm not going to expand that on a lot, but for this year, the expenditure has been increased quite substantially, bringing down the surplus from a proposed 0.8 to just 0.1% of GDP. For next year, the revenue budget has been reduced because of the lower growth, lower levels of economic activity. The next graph, please, will just show you in terms of the categories of revenue. Income and profits, it's still going up because of increased personal taxes, because of fairly high inflation-adjusted wage and salary increases that we saw. But other items such as property taxes and goods and services, in other words, VAT and on international trade, customs, that's forecast now to be lower than what we previously thought. The next graph gives it in a bit more detail, but I think we can skip that. And the final graph just summarizes that borrowing requirement, which, as I said, I think our domestic capital market can easily deal with it, but that would still leave us with the challenge of offshore finance. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much, Mr. Lobsha. Can I request that you stay right there, and we'll then take our next presenter, Mr. Ghulam Balim, to sit right next to you. All the mics, I think, are working. So depending on where he wants to sit, because his operator will be here. Can you please come forward, Mr. Balim? As I had indicated, Mr. Ghulam Balim is Chief Economist with Standard Bank. Welcome. You also have 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Okay. I won't say that again. But thanks for having me. Pleasure to visit with you. I concur in the sense that I think there is enormous forecast risk with respect to how things are likely to unfold over the next couple of months, not just in a local sense, but globally, both in terms of financial market developments as well as the real economy. However, I think I'd like to insert the idea that while there is a forecast risk, I suggest that, at least in my view, the balance of probabilities would lie to the downside. The downside in terms of the global growth dynamic, and the downside in terms of greater downside risk in terms of the general sense of how South Africa is likely to perform in terms of its real economy. I'm of the opinion that, I think we're racing ahead. I'm of the opinion that this global financial crisis is going to morph into a pretty powerful global income, earnings, and employment crunch. I think it is going to be pretty profound. Mr. Laubscher highlighted the idea of a protracted period of weakness, potentially. I think some would think about it as a soup bowl-shaped recovery. I would like to suggest that, in fact, it can perhaps look a little bit more wok-shaped, in the sense that I think it is going to be pretty weak, pretty profound in its slump, pretty profound in global economic weakness, and pretty crunching in terms of the capacity for firms to generate earnings, pretty tight in their margins, and hence with quite profound implications for, as I indicated, earnings and employment. For this particular exhibit, and the lower half is perhaps more relevant, I hope you can see it, the red line simply is the U.S. leading indicator. It continues to lose momentum. Even in the current precarious position, the leading indicator is pointing towards further dire economic conditions in that market. But I think we can also take the leading indicator as a pretty meaningful coincident indicator, contemporary indicator of what is transpiring or should be transpiring in financial markets. So in that respect, to the extent that there continues to be momentum loss in the leading indicator or gaining momentum to the downside, the travails of the financial markets, the reluctance for the financial markets, and particularly stock markets, to bottom, to rather appear to be continuously falling dagger, is really unsurprising. And I think if anything, given that some of the developed markets have become so asset-dependent, not just in terms of stock markets, but real estate as well, asset dependent in how it shapes their propensity to consume, I think we should be pretty concerned of a meaningful retrenchment in global aggregate demand. Now, I think in previous conversations with you, I've suggested I'm not a fan of decoupling. I don't believe in the idea that there is sufficient internal dynamism in the emerging world to dislodge itself, to decouple from a meaningful momentum loss in the United States. And I think if one had any doubt about the veracity of that statement, I think the evidence is to be found in commodity prices. But before I get into that, let me just very quickly articulate how I think that South Africa and maybe our trading partners are likely to be impacted in terms of the various transmission channels that will foster itself as a consequence of the U.S. economy. Firstly, there is, the obvious foreign investment dynamic. I think it's safe to note that last year was a stellar year in terms of foreign investment flows, not just to our own market, but across Africa, and in fact, generally to emerging markets. In the current climate, quite clearly, with an appetite for heightened conservatism on the part of banks to shore up capital, and just simply the lack of liberal availability of liquidity, and also from a growth-centric point of view, if growth is instead of chasing, or capital instead of chasing growth or chasing yield, is in capital preservation mode, clearly those supreme safe haven assets are going to find favor and not emerging markets, even though one can question whether genuinely U.S. treasuries are supreme. But it still appears that the world judges that to be the safest asset. And it is pretty meaningful. Just to think of our fellow African countries, remittances are pretty meaningful. I just mentioned this remark, even though it's less relevant for South Africa, it's pretty relevant for the rest of Africa, in the sense that remittances in some markets make up to 10% of GDP. In some markets, it's almost one-fifth of overall GDP is derived from the diaspora sending their income or shares or portions of their income to African countries to help bolster their growth rate. So the shares that I've just highlighted a moment ago, if you consider that in these advanced economies, which are either in or near recession, income growth, employment security is going to be challenged, and the capacity for them to be sending remittances back home is going to be so much more difficult. And this is important just to bear in mind in the sense that over the last couple of years, there's been an absolute surge and rapid growth in remittances. So this speaks through one channel of trade link as it relates to South Africa and other African markets. A third, and again, somewhat less relevant dimension for our market, but again, important for Africa, and again, the umbilical cord that extends from our market to the continent is donor flows. In fact, some markets are entirely informed by the health, the vigor, and the absorptive capacity and execution of donor aid. I think in the current market where the fiscal response in advanced economies has been so aggressive to secure their financial systems, it implies that their fiscal positions, and admittedly, they don't start from very healthy fiscal positions as our own. They start from quite weak fiscal positions, or at least in deficit. And because of the fiscal injections that they're obliged to make to either capitalize their financial systems or to provide succor to the consumer by virtue of fiscal injection, they're going to be finding themselves with even more compromised fiscal balances. And in that environment, clearly the donor community or the recipients of donors become less of a priority. The final point I would just make, and this is perhaps where South Africa is going to see enormous headwind in terms of this challenge, is simply through the trade dynamic, both in terms of prices and volumes of shipments. We know that commodities, either in its rawest or form or even mildly beneficiated, comprise nearly two-thirds of the overall export dynamic. It's not unusual that during times of global recession, the export cycle can recede, can contract by anything up to 6-7% in real terms. And I think it's highlighted in the conversations that I imagine you would have had with the Treasury, and it's in the document, in the medium-term policy statement, the downside, the lumpiness that is derived in revenue, at least, that is derived from the export dynamic from commodities. In fact, there are some single entity, single name resources firms in South Africa that contribute more than a single percentage point, full percentage point, to South Africa's revenue. So I think the volatility in revenue is going to be pronounced in the upcoming, at least over a two-year horizon. So very quickly, this exhibit was just to show if you had any doubt as to the reliability of the EM world to hold up at least half the world's sky is challenged. Commodity prices are so much more weaker. The point here is that China is the world's marginal consumer, the world's marginal price setter in the commodities market. They tell us that growth is 9% at last count in the third quarter, down from about 11.9% in the second quarter. My guess, at least if you look at commodity prices, is that that's an exaggeration. It's even lower than that if we take any guidance from the, and credibility from the commodities market. So it only speaks to the idea, I guess, of the type of exogenous shock that South Africa's real economy can experience. But let me try and drift more from the macro to, at least internationally, to South Africa. This chart, I think, matters not just from a policy budgeting perspective, but also from a national employment risk and social cohesion perspective. I've just tried to articulate your growth rates across sectors and plaster that also with respect to their labor capture, their employment share of the overall labor market, right? So if you look at, for example, the top line, the gray line, that's very vibrant and robust growth, but slipping somewhat in the construction sector. Many people will readily refer to construction and the capacity for it to hold up as being a pillar of South Africa's economy. The truth, though, and the reality is that a mere 6 out of 100 employees in South Africa's labor market find themselves with work in that particular market. If we look at the dark blue line, that is the financial business and services sector. it's frankly under slaughter, particularly in the real estate arena. Business services are also under margin pressure and less clients coming through the door. And that, at least at last count, has been declining in its growth impetus. The green line is trade and the red line is manufacturing. I think the point of this slide, and quite a poignant remark to make, at least in my view, is that if you combine finance, trade, and manufacturing, all pretty pronounced in their recent weakness, and they combined capture roughly 59 out of every 100 employees. So over the last couple of years, a significant contribution to the tax cake, to the revenue stream, has been the growth in formal sector employment. The statement makes note of the absolute surge in the number of registered taxpayers. It's about new people joining the formal economy, registering as taxpayers, and hence contributing to what I think has been mostly upside surprises in revenue. Quite simply, we created 2 million jobs over the last 5 years, what the statement tells us. It is going to be a fraction of that, if at all, positive employment creation over a two-year horizon. So, again, alluding to the idea of marked downside risk to the revenue take, in my view, at least using this as a premise. Maybe to get more to the essence of the contemporary discussion, that's public finances, I'd like to just highlight that while it is comforting and it is to be applauded that we have a public finance discussion that covers 3 years, the essence of where we stand today is really a function not of the last 3 years or the last 5 years. It's really been a journey of more than a decade. It sounds glib and it sounds, you know, quite common to say that, you know, we know the marked improvement over the last 12 years or so in terms of public finances. The exhibit that I'm showing you right now just shows you, for example, total net loan debt, you know, about a decade ago, a little bit more than that, relative today, it is just about half. That's pretty profound in terms of the deleveraging of the state in its execution of public expenditure and public finances. The budget balance is markedly better, near on balance, but it's a whole lot better, signaling the idea that there's been a greater allocation of funds to non-interest expenditure as a function of total expenditure, and I'll get to that in a moment. You know, state debt cost just reinforces the point. 4% back in 1993, 1994, in fact, just a few years ago, it was close to 6%. So it's about one quarter of its peak only a few years ago. Perhaps not quite an efficiency statement, but the last line in that exhibit, non-interest expenditure, accounted for a mere 82% of total expenditure some 14 years ago. It has risen almost uninterruptedly to around 91% of total expenditure, again highlighting the quality of expenditure in the overall public finances space. And I think that, again, is to be applauded. But what I'm working to, and as highlighted by the next exhibit, is that this is not a sort of a success or a celebration that has been really of more recent public policy choices. What I've plastered on this graph is the incremental changes in South Africa's sovereign credit rating since back in the day, right? So over the last 14 years, it has been consistent, it has been incremental, and it has been over some length of time. I guess what I'm alluding to here is that if there were two words that were to describe perhaps the current finance minister and policy over this period, it is credibility and consistency. The thing about consistency is that it takes time. And my sense is we're on the precipice of a change regime in terms of uncertainty, questions surrounding where policy will anchor itself. The consistency part takes some while. It is not just going to be where the metrics anchor themselves this year, next year, and in the out year of a three-year horizon, but how they remain more or less within sort of particular benchmark levels over the longer term, during both testing times, during tough economic times, and during times when you know, popular demands rise because of economic hardship. And this is a new era. We're almost going to have to reinvent credibility and consistency. Now, the reason that I put this chart up is not is to one highlight, I guess, the celebratory judgment that jumps out of this. But I think you will recall that we, in fact, in the recent couple of months, went backwards just a little bit. Not in absolute terms. We continue to be rated, you know, quite favorably and have held the absolute ratings that I'm highlighting here, BBB+, from both Standard & Poor's and Fitch. But you will recall that Standard & Poor's in April shifted South Africa's sovereign credit rating from positive to stable. In other words, it retraced. Fitch did the same in June. This is the first time that, while not in terms of the absolute metric, but in terms of the guiding signal, we've gone backwards. In other words, whereas a positive rating embracing a positive judgment embracing our BBB+ rating would have meant that over at least a two-year horizon, South Africa probably would have entered the very coveted A investment grade category rating, which would imply lower financing costs, lower risk premiums, just a genuinely more better macro political and financial environment so as to encourage lower financing charges. That seems to have reached somewhat of a stop, at least not a further, not an imminent advance, not a retracing, absolutely. But I think it is in the current cyclical environment and with the fluidity in the political space, it is something to think about in how we interrogate the public finances and not just the signals we send over the next year or so. Moving on to the next exhibit, and maybe bringing to bear the downside growth risk that I highlighted at the beginning. This is an exhibit that I've drawn from the Treasury statement, and it's alluded to the idea of introducing a structural balance so as to isolate the cyclical injections into contemporary public finances. I think it is noteworthy that the structural balance shifts over the next couple of years to close to 2%. I think when we consider that as a rule of thumb, not as a hard line, but as a when one considers that a 3% budget deficit is the kind of zone when you begin to threshold, when beyond which we begin to traverse somewhat, not unstable public finance management, but when public finance become a little bit less integrous, a little bit, you know, precarious. So I guess what I'm suggesting is that the headroom between the structural balance as anticipated by the National Treasury, when mounted with the idea that there's more downside global growth risk and more downside domestic growth risk, it suggests that that particular structural balance is more prone, in my view, to 3% budget deficit than, say, 1% in the current climate. And as a consequence, a steady hand is perhaps more than ever required in the current atmosphere. Moving on to the next chart, and maybe just to isolate, because of the brevity of time, to focus on one particular area. In recent budgets, the accent has been elevated in terms of its focus on fixed investment. Now, this exhibit shows you public sector neglect. One can almost call it public sector strike over the last 20 or 30 years in terms of its relative contribution to the overall investment mosaic. For example, back in 1980, every R1 of public overall investment emanated from the public sector and the other half came from the private sector. There's been a general and almost persistent decline in that contribution. We know now, and very favorably so, that there's been an unambiguous reacceleration. Acceleration in terms of public sector contribution. In fact, public sector spend in real terms will grow between anything ranging from 15 to 20% over the next couple of years, and way ahead, in my view, of what is likely to emanate from the private sector, meaning that the public sector is going to recoup its share or more palatable share of its contribution to investment. But what I'd like to tear into more substantively is the following exhibit, which just shows you the potential multiplier responses from investment. You know, of all the type of fiscal expenditures or categories that government can commit to, while certainly one can argue that it can't avoid providing income tax relief during tough times, so also when there is a high incidence or gauge to be a high incidence of income tax relief, it also has to spend on social services. But investment quite clearly has the most powerful long-term multiplier. It gives you the greatest bang for public sector buck. In fact, what this argument or this particular exhibit suggests is that for every 1 rand of allocations towards investment, it is quite feasible and possible that it generates over the longer term an incremental 2 rand to GDP growth. So quite clearly, at least from the efficiency, while I'm not wishing to suggest that every single rand suddenly gets allocated to investment, both from a productivity point of view and from a GDP lift point of view, it's unambiguously handsome and welcome. So the next particular exhibit is therefore to be applauded in the sense that the share of public sector investment in the overall consolidated expenditure framework has risen markedly. I would just add as some additional footnotes to this particular exhibit. We know that on an average basis, the economy contributes for every 1 million rand of production, 1 million rand of GDP, it sustains about 8 jobs. We estimate that the public sector program of the state has the capacity to contribute or sustain approximately 12 jobs for every 1 million rand. So clearly, it contributes better to the average employment multiplier of the economy. But that's quite obvious, one would argue, given the nature of infrastructure expenditure, which tends to be quite employment intensive. But I would even argue in the very raw construction side of the state's public sector program, expenditure program, investment program, here the capacity to create jobs for every 1 million rand of expenditure is even greater than 20, quite potentially. And that, I say, in the very narrow area of construction, it doesn't relate to sort of the machinery and equipment export. So it's powerful in employment multiplier and therefore powerful in terms of the social welfare dimension that it can also address, even if it isn't immediately in the social welfare categorization of public finance expenditure. So let me just to bring my sentiments to conclusion. My sense is that we're on the precipice of a crunch in global aggregate demand. That is going to be lengthy, protracted, and probably wok-shaped. I think that 2.5% GDP growth next year is eminently plausible. Now, immediately you would say that's still positive. It's still forward in its momentum. I would even argue that 2.5% GDP growth probably exaggerates the underlying sentiment and the underlying sense of consumer well-being. And in fact, it's perhaps a veneer that is kept respectable because investment is going to grow relatively robustly and well ahead of consumer fundamentals. My fellow panelists made the point a little bit earlier, if I understood correctly, that this is, you know, it's a necessary adjustment process that the world is going to have to go through in terms of the global revisiting the global financial architecture, and one can refer to it as creative destruction. It's a type of punishment, the type of purging process that the world and financial system needs to go through to come out stronger on the other side. I think that South Africa is going to see a meaningful interruption in what has been a secular rise in its growth trend over the last decade or so. It is that cyclical headwind, its sharpness, the nature of its interruption that can easily dislodge us from remaining anchored to very, not conservative, but pragmatic and sustainable policy choices. I've argued previously, and I'll just revisit the point. I've said to you in the past, one of the desirable characteristics of good public finances is flexibility. Flexibility to change one's choices, so to be able to call on public finance or the powder that has been kept dry in public finances during tough times, without impeaching the general structure of public finances. This is a time, and I guess you can call on that surpluses that have been built over the last couple of years to serve as the white knight in an otherwise failing economy, particularly with regard to consumer fundamentals. I would argue that the cycle over the last couple of years has contributed to an under-promising over-delivery. There is a potential in the current down cycle for over-promise and under-delivery. And I don't mean that in a sort of cynical fashion or a deliberate attempt by any party to mislead, but it's just where the balance of risks lie, in my view. And then I think finally, I think this probably brings my presentation to a conclusion. To close it and say thank you for the opportunity to share some dialogue and thoughts with you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berlin. Can I then request Mr. David Rod to join you? No, you can keep your seats. Maybe, it's okay. If you prefer to all speak from that one, that's fine. Okay. Have you got Mr. David Rod's permission? Bradley, you want to help locate Mr. David Rod's submission? See, Mr. David Rod, you've given us quite a heavy presentation. I just hope it's not as long as it looks.
No, of course. Thank you. I just want to say thank you very much for the opportunity. When I look through the agenda, I realize that I am going to be the last of the economists, and I reckon, and it turned out to be like that they will spend quite some time on the international economy, correctly. But I thought, obviously, I'm not going to go through all of that, because I'm sure by now you will know more or less what's going on internationally. And I would like to go back to just a few basic things about any economy. And I've even got a couple of laws on the economy. Before I go on with my presentation, sir, may I say that, you know, economists, whenever they talk to people, they give you slides and they give you numbers. And people think that economists are heartless people. Economists are not. I think we are all just as worried about the poverty and the poor people and unemployed people in the country, and we all want, I'm sure I speak for my colleagues as well, that we all want everybody to have nice houses, to have schools, to have jobs and everything like that. Quite often, however, we have to make decisions that could be painful in the short term, but it will be for the benefit of long-term health of your economy as well. Okay, let me get going, sir, by just starting off with the basics again, and I would like to show you this first slide. And this is just a simple example of an economy. Let's assume a closed economy and an economy that produces 100 units. You can call it 100 bags of millions, you can call it 100 trousers, you can call it whatever you want. Say an economy produces 100. Under circumstances like this, this economy can only consume 100. It's impossible to consume more. It's a closed economy. You produce 100, you can only consume 100. If, however, you want to grow the economy over time, then you have to take part of your production, you have to reinvest that. So if you're a maize farmer, for example, you can't consume all your 100 bags of maize. You have to keep 10 bags of maize apart so you can plant it for the next year. That's called investment. But that, unfortunately, means you can't consume 100. You have to cut back on your consumption, and you can only consume, in this example, 90. The next one, sir, let's introduce the state. If you introduce the state, in this example, the state takes a city away from the economy. And that simply means, as the state takes a city away from the economy, there will be less for the rest of the economy to consume, and in this instance, the example is that it falls from a consumption of 90 to a consumption of 30 available to the rest of the economy. However, the state also contributes for some of this maize that the state takes out of the economy, they put back into the economy again. Can I get to the next slide, please? But it put back into the economy, and that means that the total consumption of the private sector can go up a little bit. So essentially what the state does, it takes money out of the economy and spends some of the money back, some of this maize back in the economy, allowing the private sector to spend a little bit more. Now let's introduce, but become a little bit more realistic. Now what I've done there, that circle around that, in the case of South Africa, we consume, not 100, in the case of South Africa, we consume 108. And that's the third, but that's the circle around there. We consume everything that we produce locally plus an additional 8. And that additional 8 is equal to our current account deficit. So we consume more than what we produce. Okay? And it's okay, you can consume more than what you produce, like in this example. But, and that's the next slide, the time will come that in a period thereafter you will consume less than what you produce. There's no way getting away from this. The reason why I've gone through this little basic economic model is that many of the economic presentations include a lot of numbers, and we call them so much rand for this and so much interest rate for that, but really matters is the real economy. What's going on? How many bags of millis do we produce, for example? The real economy is really that what matters. And I've gone through this little presentation to show that if you have so far, that if you have so much available, you can't consume more than what you have available, because that is just the reality of life. Okay, I've also decided to touch on one or two laws about the economy. Now, if you listen to economists, you will hear words like, for example, perhaps, or maybe, or expected, or, you know, estimated. Economists don't say will or shall. Economists are very careful to use words like that, because we don't know what is going to happen tomorrow. There are a few places where I am prepared to use a word like will, for example. Now, the economic law number one, money is not wealth. This is extremely important. I think the previous few slides that I've showed, it has to do with the real economy. It's not about the money economy. It is very easy to make money. It's much more difficult to create wealth. Wealth are the stuff that we eat, the services that we enjoy, the cars that we drive in, the houses that we live in. That is wealth, not money. I lecture at the University of Pretoria. One of my students is a teacher from Zimbabwe. His last salary was 6.4 billion Zim dollars. He most definitely does not have a problem with money, but he most definitely has a huge problem with wealth. So that is extremely important. Money is not wealth. If we get to the second slide, this will show it more or less what's been happening in South Africa. The top line, the blue one, is how we increase our pool of money in South Africa. And the bottom one is how we increase our pool of wealth in South Africa. Now, as you can quite clearly see, and I don't want to get into theoretical argument with my colleagues here, because I am going to lose this theoretical argument. I just want to make a point. And the point is that if you increase your pool of money at a rate in excess of your pool of wealth, eventually that difference will pop out in one way or the other, and the way it will come out is by way of higher inflation. Okay. The next slide is a bit of a, we played around a little bit with stats, just to again show the relationship there more or less. In the blue, the top line, and this money supply, and you can see as money supply goes up, and the creation or the increase in the pool of money is also pulling inflation up. There's some political or rather statistical engineering behind that specific graph, so, but at the bottom line, what I want to show and what I want to illustrate, if you create money in your economy, eventually it will come out somewhere, and not necessarily by way of an increase in wealth in your economy. Let me get to the next slide. Now, I have some estimates here on what I expect is going to happen on the economy. I've got some predictions on interest rates, and I've got things on inflation. But all bets are off now. I don't know what is going to happen. And especially after yesterday and the day before, when the rand took a huge knock. In fact, the last week, I haven't had a clue on what's really going on. So my estimates here are seriously soft. I don't know what's going to happen because, for instance, I don't know what's going to happen to the exchange rate of the rand. But I think the general trend will be more or less right. I've got two lines here. The top line is the inflation rate in South Africa. And as you can see, in our estimates at least, and I think my colleagues will agree with me more or less, that the rate of inflation is perhaps close to the top now, but I do think that inflation is likely to remain fairly high for quite a long period of time. I don't 100% agree with the Minister of Finance that inflation will get close to 6% next year, especially with the rand where it is at the moment. That's going to be extremely difficult. The point is, we have inflation in South Africa, and the monster called inflation, the impact of inflation on the economy will be much more severe than the impact of a relatively high interest rate on the short term. The bottom line there is real interest rate. Now, remember, if you borrow money from the bank or if you want to save money in a bank, first of all, you want to be compensated for inflation and then you want a return. Okay? So your interest rate must always be or should always be higher than the inflation rate. As you can see at the bottom line, currently South Africa's interest rates are in real term negative. It makes sense to keep on borrowing money, because interest rates are too low. And I would like to make this point, I think, and of course it's easy with hindsight, but I think the Reserve Bank was a little bit too aggressive in cutting rates on the downside, and the Reserve Bank did not start increasing interest rates enough when they eventually started the increase interest rates. Okay, I agree with the direction, I just think they should have done more. Let me get to economic law number two. Individuals always pay all taxes. Now that's a word economists don't use, always. Let me get to the next one and let me go through that. There I have a slide of the different taxes in South Africa, the different contributions from the different revenue sources of the fiscus. Now, we know that value-added tax, for example, is paid mostly by individuals. You go to Pick and Pay and you will see that you will be paying value-added tax, for instance. We also know that personal income taxes, and I understand the parliamentarians getting received quite a nice increase. You will also see that if you look at your pay slip, that your personal income tax would have gone up. Company taxes, people think that company taxes are paid by some entity somewhere. Well, company taxes are not paid by some entity somewhere. You pay company taxes. And let me give you an example. If you go out and you buy a packet of cigarettes, for instance, included in your packet of cigarettes will be value-added tax, of course. Included in your packet of cigarettes will be, for example, the sin taxes, customs duties, for instance. But included in that packet of cigarettes is also the company taxes of that specific company. If you levy a tax on a company, the company will do one of three things. The company will increase the prices of its goods and services, or the company will pay its workers less or give them smaller increases, or the company will pay smaller dividends to its shareholders. The company is not paying that tax. Companies never pay taxes. All taxes are always paid by individuals. That's an economic law. Next law, please, sir. Next law, perhaps if I can just go back to that one. I've made a quick calculation. The per capita tax in South Africa, which is, of course, incorrect, but the per capita tax in South Africa, and I'll get back to that a little bit later, it's about 13,000 rand at the moment a year. Next one, sir. The next law. People react to incentives. That's a law in economics. So, and I've got a nice slide here just to show you all your employees. New incentive plan, work, all get fined. The next economic law. Production and consumption always converge. Okay? You can't produce more, or you can't consume more than what you produce indefinitely. The next slide should show this. This is South Africa's current account deficit. Now, the current account is that red line that at the end of the graph dips below the black line. The black line is zero. Okay? That red line dipping down there is the difference between how much we import and how much we export. Now, coming back to that graph I showed you earlier, remember if we produce 100, you can only consume more than what you produce if foreigners are prepared to lend you some of that millis that you want to consume more than what you're producing. And that's that top line, the blue one. That is an inflow of capital coming into South Africa. So we're consuming more than what we're producing, the bottom line, and we can do that because foreigners in the top line are lending us what we are consuming more than what we are producing. The opposite is happening right now. Foreigners are wanting that money back. They take the money out of South Africa, and they want to put it on their own balance sheet. There are many reasons for that. If they take the money out of South Africa now, it means, and this is inevitable, that we must consume less than in the previous period. It's an economic law. Now, where is this money coming from? And my colleagues alluded to this as well. Some of this money, or the bulk of this money, is coming in by way of so-called hot money. It's money that's quite liquid. It's money that can come in and go quite quickly. And this is one of the downsides of having a very sophisticated economy like what we have. It's easy to put money in, and it's also easy to take money out. And that's part of the reason why we see the rand suddenly weakening. I've got one or two warnings, if I may. I would like to warn about unintended consequences, and I'll get back to this a little bit later. The first unintended consequence is that if you keep on paying bankrupt companies money, they will stay bankrupt. The next one is my favorite, actually, South African Airways. South African Airways has been getting billions, so many billions of rands from me and from your pockets, and they are going to ask for another 5 billion in next year's budget. We can't do this. We can't keep on keeping bankrupt companies alive. at the expense of probably Nationwide, at the expense of SunAir, for instance, it is immoral, let me repeat that, it is immoral to take tax money from one time to use this money to subsidize their competition, South African Airways. We must stop doing this. It's wrong to keep on subsidizing bankrupt companies like South African Airways. Let me a warning about something else. I would like to warn about misplaced targets. I've got a list of my misplaced targets. Whenever you listen to politicians, they tell us we've got an unemployment problem, poverty problem, and all that. I would like to propose that we shift the emphasis of the economic and social problems that we have in South Africa. And I've got some suggestions, if I may. We do not have an unemployment problem in South Africa. We do not have enough entrepreneurs. That's the real problem. Secondly, we don't have a poverty problem in South Africa. The problem is we do not have enough wealth. The emphasis should be how can we create more wealth. A very easy example is the cars and the roads thing from my good friend Chris Hart. He says, we don't have too many cars for the roads, we have too few roads for the cars. Simple as that. Food prices. Food prices are not too high. There's not enough food. That is the actual problem. What can we do to create more entrepreneurs? What can we do to create more wealth, have more roads, and get more food? That's the real problem. Not unemployment and poverty, for instance. Okay, the South African economy, just a quick glance on a few things in the South African economy. Like I said earlier, all bets are off now. I don't know what's going to happen now. I've had economic growth estimates for this year around about 3% and a slowdown for next year, in line with my colleagues. I'm not so sure about that 3% anymore. I don't know what the Reserve Bank is going to do. I think chances are very good that the Reserve Bank may be increasing interest rates again. I think, by the way, it will be the right thing to do. But around about 3%, there is a slowdown in the economy. That is very, very clear. The current account, the next slot, please, sir. The current account deficit this year, that is also likely to fall now. With the rand weakening significantly, the current account deficit is likely to shrink a little bit. But still, a significant current account deficit. And the exchange rate of the currency, that was my estimate not so long ago, 8.70 at the end of this year. I just don't know what is going to happen now. Maybe it will come back. I doubt it whether it will come back to 8.70 at the end of the year against the dollar. But it may improve somewhat. I just don't know what's going to happen. And that is the key, of course, what's going to happen on the current account deficit and many other aggregates in the South African economy. The next one is just on money supply growth. I just want to highlight one or two numbers there. That M3 is the pool of money. I talked about that a little bit earlier. That is also that's continuing to increase at the rate of double figures, probably around about 18-19% increase for this year. That's too high. That's not wealth. That's money. The second line there, so the private sector credit extension, the demand for credit in South Africa remains too high. We borrow too much money. And if we borrow too much money, our debt levels will keep on going up. Or fortunately, it's been slowing or stabilizing at least. And the other side of the same coin pretty much is how much we save, and our savings are just too low in South Africa as well. I'm going to get back to savings just now. Inflation rate, and again, inflation well above the targeted range. Part of the reason I would argue is because the Reserve Bank monetary policy stance was too soft. I don't know what's going to happen to inflation next year, but I will probably have to adjust my estimates upwards because of the recent volatility in the currency. The last one that they have, the interest rates, and again, I don't know what the Reserve Bank is going to do, but if the rand remains at 11 to the US in 2 months' time, I don't think the Reserve Bank will have much of a choice but to increase interest rates. And that means that the economic growth next year could quite easily fall to 2% or even below 2%. It's a tough time ahead of us. Let me get to the fiscal policy and the next one. This is just a summary on what's been happening on a fiscal policy the major movements on fiscal policy the last since 1980. The top line is state expenditure. This is how much money the Minister of Finance is spending. And this is a ratio to GDP as a percentage of the economy. Okay? You can see the top line has been coming down from about 29% of GDP, and then from 2003, that top line has been going up again, that blue line. And I'm going to spend some time on that a little bit later. The bottom line is state revenue, or another word for that is the tax burden on the economy. And the tax burden increased from about 22% of GDP to currently in excess of 27% of GDP. there was a huge increase. There was a huge increase in the tax burden in South Africa. A big increase. A 5% GDP increase is massive. It's quite big. Also keep in mind, and I've tried to highlight it there, if you spend more than what you get in, that's referred to as the fiscal deficit. The fiscal deficit is nothing but a tax. It is a delayed tax, but it is a tax. You will have to pay for that sometime in the future. Currently we have a fiscal surplus. I expect the fiscal surplus to be around about 0.2 or so to GDP in the current financial year, and thereafter we are likely to see the fiscal surplus moving and the fiscal deficit again. I want to go just through some revenue figures and some revenue numbers. And can you go back once? Go one, only one, no, not two, just go one back. I want to show one at a time. Can you go back? Okay, go one, so it jumps forward immediately. All right, let me go through then. This is an illustration on what's been happening on the composition of the different revenue items in the fiscus the last couple of years. There are two slides on top of each other there, so you can't see what I really want to show you. But what I want to show you here is that there was a significant increase in the contribution of companies to the fiscus the last couple of years. That's the main point that I want to make. So companies are contributing much more to the fiscus than in the past. Remember, the whole thing went up. The total take of the Minister of Finance out of the economy has gone up significantly, and the composition of that has changed also, and companies are contributing much more now. Next one, please. I just want to compare some of the budget and the medium-term figures to my estimate here, and I'm just going to highlight a single one there, unless there are questions about the others. Value-added tax collections in the current financial year will probably be significantly lower than what the Minister is telling us there. And that has to do, obviously, with the slowdown in demand in the South African economy. The next slide makes the point I'm trying to make. Remember, if you increase taxes on people, they will have less money over to spend on something else. That is just the reality. Now, what we have seen, what I have here, is two lines, and this is on households. The top line is how much tax they are paying, and the bottom line is how much they are saving. Now, you can see quite clearly, look at the last part where those arrows are. There's some noise in the past, and we can talk about that as well, but I just want to emphasize that last 2 points. Let me just get back to monetary policy. My point is, part of the reason why we don't have sufficient savings in South Africa is because interest rates were too low. But another reason why we don't have sufficient savings in South Africa is because taxes on the potential savers has gone up, and this is proof of that. This is on personal income taxes. Let me show you the next one on companies. Companies, and it's very easy to see this. Company taxes the past couple of years has gone up. There's very good reasons why. Better compliance, for instance, is a good reason. Fact, however, remains the company taxes has gone up. The state is taking a bigger chunk from companies in the past. If company taxes go up, they are the only real savers left in the economy, by the way. They will save less. That's how it works. I just want to compare us with the rest of the world. The next slide. This is just South Africa's company taxes. South Africa's, this is on individuals. And South Africa's, we can go through that, individual taxes, the previous one, please. Individual taxes are generally higher than most individual taxes in the world. The next one, company taxes, are generally higher. And in fact, if you add silly tax on companies, also known as secondary tax on companies, you will find that South Africa's taxes on companies are of the highest in the world. The next one, value added tax, there the opposite is true. Compared to the rest of the world, our value-added taxes, of course, on the lower side. Now, why this distinction? Because if you increase personal income taxes or income taxes generally, the impact of that will be, of course, lower consumption, but it will also lead to lower savings. If you increase VAT, for example, the impact will mainly be of lower consumption. And there's always this balance on how much you can consume. You can't consume more than what you produce. The next one, please. And if I can skip that one and go to the next one, and the next one. And go again, please. All right. Now, there again, we're going to have exactly the same problem. I've highlighted a few points in the revenue side, on the tax burden side of the economy. I just want to touch on one, two things on the expenditure side. So this money is being taken from us, and this money is being spent somewhere. And again, there are two slides there, and the one, unfortunately, is on top of the other one, so you can't see what's going on there. I will just go through it, and I will explain to you what's been happening. I'm comparing 1994 to this financial year, and that yellow part, that is social expenditure. What we have seen from 1994 to now is a very, very large increase in social expenditure. Of course, one would have expected that. There are very good political and very good social reasons why you have to spend more on things like the child support grant, on poverty alleviation, because we have a huge poverty problem in South Africa, or a lack of wealth, perhaps is a better one. On the right-hand side, there are the major social expenditure items. That black one is social expenditure on education. That red one is expenditure on health services. Those two have remained more or less unchanged the past, say, 15 years. The top one, that is so-called social development, and that includes the different grants. And the different grants increased, well, I have to use the word dramatically, especially the last couple of years. And over the period of, say, 10, 15 years, there was a huge increase. So we are spending a lot of money on poor people, which is the right thing, and I'm not arguing against that. Part of the reason why we can do this is because state debt came down quite a lot. If state debt goes down, we don't pay so much on interest on state debt, and we can use this interest to spend it on something like, for example, the different grants. Unfortunately, there's always a price to be paid as well. Next one, if we can just skip that as well. All right, so let me just summarize what's been happening on the revenue side and the fiscus. The tax burden shifted to the potential savers, and therefore they're saving less. On the expenditure side of the fiscus, the expenditure emphasis shifted to poverty alleviation. If you give poor people money, they spend that. So the fiscus has been, despite the fact that the fiscus, that we have a fiscal surplus today, the fiscus is, in fact, remember, it's not a snapshot, it is a video. And if you compare the fiscus, state revenue and expenditure over time, the fiscus has been, despite the fact that we have a fiscal surplus, has been expansionary, has been boosting consumption in the South African economy. Okay? I've showed this chamber this next slide some time ago, and I've made some calculations, and I'm not going to bore you with all that. I've made some assumptions. One assumption that I think is a bit unrealistic, to use that word, is that I assume the state is effective and efficient. Let's assume that argument, say. It is possible to calculate what the tax burden is on different families, and I've done this. Obviously, if you earn 20,000 rand, the top family number one there per year, very, very poor family, they don't pay income taxes, but they pay other taxes. They pay value-added taxes and sin taxes and so on. The bottom family that earns 1 million rand per year, for instance, they pay a lot of income taxes, but they also pay much more VAT in nominal terms because they've got more money to spend, and they pay a lot of company taxes and so on. So the point on the revenue side is that poor families pay less, rich families pay more. However, if you look at the expenditure side, if you look at the expenditure side of the fiscus, you will find that it is directed to poverty alleviation for very good reasons, and that means that the bulk of state expenditure goes to poor people and less goes to rich people. Okay? So they take from the rich and give to the poor, which is part of the function for the state. I'm not disagreeing with that. But how much is my question? And that's the last, look at the last column there. If you earn 20,000 rand per year, very, just go back one please. The last column, if you earn 20,000 rand per year, you're a very poor family. For every 1 rand you pay to the state, you get back about 16 rand. That's an excellent investment. If you're a rich family, you earn about 1 million rand per year. Every 1 rand you pay taxes, you get back less than 5 cents in the form of goods and services from the state. It is dramatically redistributional to the fiscus in South Africa. For understandable reasons, I'm the messenger here, but you pay a price for that. I've put it on a graph just to show you. And this is what it looks like with different income categories before the Trevor Manuel does his magic. After his magic, what he does, he takes from the rich and he gives to the poor. And let's assume he takes everything from everybody and he dishes it out on exactly the same basis to everybody else. So he distributes everything equally in the economy. It will look like this, the green line, the next one. And that's it. That's what it would have looked like if all the income would have been. Now, what you can see, a lot is taken from the rich guys, and there are relatively few of them. And rich, I'm not talking about rich guys like parliamentarians. I'm talking about people earning 100,000 plus per year. That's my definition of rich. So those are the people paying the money, the taxes, and the guys getting the money of people of an income below that. The next slide, if I may show you this, you can't see the next slide. If somebody earns R1 million, for instance, and he should decide to emigrate, if that person emigrates, the state will lose funding for approximately 15 poor families. That's for education services, health services, and all that. Okay, the next, I just want to touch on one or two things. The Minister of Finance, this is a quote from the Minister of Finance, saying that we are acting financially responsibly, which I agree with. The Minister of Finance also refers to a specific report about the health of the financial system and the banks in South Africa, which I agree with. Unfortunately, there are one or two messages that I think the Minister of Finance has forgotten to share with us as well. And the next slide, I've compiled this slide. Remember, the state takes money from our pockets and they spend it. My question is, are they spending it well? Are they spending it financially well? Is it good financial management? This is the Auditor General's report. The red blocks there are for state departments that received qualified audits. A qualified audit, if you're a director at a listed company and you get a qualified audit in your company, you're going to look for another job. It means it's bad financial management. Simple as that. Look at that trend. Look at the bottom one, Home Affairs. I was there 2 days ago. I stood in a queue for 5 hours just to hand in my paper for an application of a passport. That's not good enough. And you can see that in the Auditor General's report. This, the way the state is managing my money, is not good. I just want to touch on one or two things as well. Education, for instance. This is just an example. Okay, the next slide. How much money do we spend? This is just an example. The next slide, please. How much money do we spend on education? So, to give you a quick answer, South Africa spends more on education than most economies in the world. So, we spend a lot of money on education. How much are we getting back? The next slide will show this. This is a report, a so-called Pearls report by the U.S. Department of Education. There are many similar kind of reports. They looked at 30 economies. There are four. The Pearl report, what they do, they give kids in grade 4 a comprehension test. So listen, it's a very good test. It measures your reading abilities and it measures your insight in what you've read. You can fall into four potential categories, a very high category. No country made it in a very high category. A high category, the Russian Federation was on top, an intermediate one. The United States is somewhere there. And then you've got a low category in Macedonia. And then countries like South Africa and Qatar, we did so badly, they had to create a special category for us. We are at the bottom of the pile in this specific report. We spend more money on education than most, but the outcome is worse than most. This is not good financial management. It's not about money. It's about good management as well, and I think this illustrates. I just want to add touch on one or two more things. Social Security. I alluded to the fact that there was a huge increase in expenditure on Social Security. Currently, probably about 13 million people. At the end of next year, it will probably be about 15 million people receiving some sort of grant from the state. That's a quarter of the population. There are about 5 million registered income taxpayers. There are 13 million people receiving grants. This is unsustainable. We can't keep on increasing this. I realize the poverty problem in South Africa, but South Africa is a poor country. And I also alluded to some things like, for example, people reacting incentive. I've got a few incentives. If you pay old age grants, for instance, please the next one, that could be incentive not to save so much. I know you're going to ask me how can poor people save, but again, South Africa is a poor country. There are many reports saying that people want to stay sick because they receive these different grants. I know there are some programs in place to address this, but there are reports of that. There are reports of girls falling pregnant in order to get this grant. If you pay the incentive, if you pay girls because they get babies, they will get babies. And then lastly, of course, there are just far too many people on receiving. We have to get fewer people that are dependent on the state, not more. Just a few ones. Just go to the next one, please, sir. Just a few on the summary. Next one, please. Just a summary on state finances the last couple of years. This is the bottom line figure is the fiscal deficit, the fiscal surplus. And now we've had a fiscal surplus now. We're probably going to go into a deficit situation, and I have to update those numbers. The deficit may be a little bit larger. But I think what should be what is really worthwhile noticing is that fiscal deficit, which were in the region of about 7-odd% of GDP, came down to where it is to a surplus now. That was a tough job. I think that was a job well done by the Minister of Finance, an excellent job. And therefore, the next slide, if you reduce your fiscal deficit, your debt burden will keep on coming down as well. And therefore, if your debt burden keeps on coming down, then the next one, your interest on state debt will be coming down as well, quite significantly. That's my presentation, sir. I just want to thank you for that. I think the message I'm trying to send, I know that we all want South Africa to be rich. I realize of the poverty problem in South Africa, but nobody, no country, no individual can spend itself rich. We better spend our money much more wisely. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Roth. That's three presentations. Members, I hope you've been making notes. Very insightful, some very interesting. And, a lot of information has come out. Questions? Comments? Mr. Maloto, Dr. George, Mr. Mbili, Mr. Mungoni, Mr. Schneeman, Ms. What did you do? Oh, Ms. Makoto. You know, the moment I wanted to recognize you, you I thought you were pulling back. Okay, Mr. Maloto. No, Ms. Sibila. Yeah. Mr. Maloto.
Thank you, Chair. I'm interested in the comment that was made by Mr. David Root, where he's saying that our inflation is high. Am I audible? Okay. I'll keep the mic. Let me keep the mic. I'm interested in the comment that was made by David Root, where he's saying that the part of the reason that our inflation is high is because of the soft stance that has been taken by the Reserve Bank. Now, say, I just want to differ a bit with you, and say, okay, maybe that could be partly true, but let's look at this other scenario. The European Central Bank has been missing the inflation target for 8 years, or almost. The Bank of England has been recently, it has indicated that they have been missing their target for obvious reasons, because of food prices and oil prices. Turkey, I think, had to change its band, its inflation targeting band. Now, your argument would be, I'm trying to follow the logic of your argument. Are you saying that the Reserve Bank should have increased interest rates aggressively? And if that's your argument, my question would be, at what cost to the economy? Because obviously, and I would argue that the stance that has been taken by the Reserve Bank of increasing interest rates gradually was responsible enough to ensure that inflation comes down gradually, and at the same time not harm the economy. Because an aggressive or a hawkish approach to this whole issue would have hurt the economy very badly. That's my argument. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but I would want to hear your argument on this matter. The other question, Chair, is directed to the other presenters. I think Mr. Balim is making also a very interesting point, which I agree with him. He's saying this: the issue of decoupling can never work. But then I just want to pose this question: the information that's contained in the medium-term budget statement indicates that 36% of South Africa's manufactured exports are sold to the group of seven industrialized countries. In contrast, only about 5% of such exports go to BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. How then do we ensure that we protect ourselves in this environment? Because the governor of the Bank of England just said recently that England is going into a recession. Now, what do you advise? How do we protect ourselves in this? Because if you look at this percentage, obviously we are not exporting much to BRIC. Most of our exports are concentrated in these developed countries, and they are currently experiencing problems. What would be your advice in this matter? How then do we diversify our exports? And the last one, Chair, it's also indicated, I think it's page 24 of this medium-term budget policy statement, that, let me read the statement, say a degree of risk, however, is associated with a large current account deficit. The policy response to mitigating this is as follows. One, strengthening supportive measures already in place, especially in relation to prudential supervision of the banking system. Two, increasing domestic savings. The part that I'm interested in is this last point of improving net trade performance to generate greater resources for investment. But also the report agrees that the last two are the most difficult. But how then do we address this thing of increasing of our net trade performance? Also, given that our manufacturing, our mining is not doing well and our agriculture is not doing well, what type of advice can you give us?
Dr. Church.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your very interesting and informative presentations. I would agree with an assessment that the current turmoil on the international financial markets is part of the process of creative destruction. And part of that process also means that there's opportunity for something will emerge. And if you have a look at South African economy, what opportunities are there for South Africa, given the fact that we are not sitting firmly in the developed world? So within this turmoil, the global turmoil and the effects on our real economy, what opportunities come out of this for us? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Ngoni.
Thank you, Chair. I just ask a question to all the panelists. So, given the current economic situation globally and at home, the governor as well as the minister said we have to now to be pragmatic and throw away the textbook and deal with the reality. Now, looking at the inflation at the current account deficit and the financial crisis we're facing, what would be the best way out for South Africa in this situation? The 24.4 billion rand extra that is going to be injected, how will it affect the economy? Do you think it's going to improve the situation or worsen the situation? Treasury speaks of a competitive exchange rate. What would you say is a competitive exchange rate currently, seeing the current account deficit is widening? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Mbili.
Thanks, Chair. Over the past recent years, when the budget is tabled, the Minister of Finance presented the budget, tabled the budget, and a few months later presented the medium-term budget statement. The market had in the past reacted very positively to the benefits of our currency. You know, when we woke up on Tuesday, the rand was in the region of 10 rand in the morning. And after the presentation on Tuesday, the rand just jumped to 11 rand. My question will be, what will have triggered the rand, or maybe what Trevor did wrong this time? Because to me, layman, sounds as if that reaction had everything to do, notwithstanding the crisis, the current worldwide economic meltdown, but that specific day. For me, it seems as if something went terribly wrong. What would be that? The first one, Chair. The second one and the last would be the Millennium Goal targets of halving unemployment by half. In the year 2014, in the light of the crisis globally, how feasible is that? And subsequent to that, the link to that, the Alliance Economic Summit recently, as in last week, have come out with this ambitious kind of which in my view is linked to that call of halving poverty by half by the year 2014, have come up with this massive plan of creating jobs, employment of 5 million. What is your analytic take to that? Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Schneemann, can I just request members to please be brief in their questions. We unfortunately are working against time. We started late, 15 minutes late, because members took time to get in, and we are already running 30 minutes behind time, and we still have three more presentations. Mr. Schneemann, sorry.
No, thanks, Chairperson. My question is really directed to Mr. Ruert. And it's just the comments that you've made around the grants and so on. You seem to be indicating, if I understand you correctly, that you're saying that we shouldn't spend more on grants. You seem to be indicating that these grants are not helping. But if we had to spend less, if we had to remove some of these grants, surely we'd be increasing poverty in our country. I'm just trying to understand what you're trying to say. Perhaps you could expand on that, because many of these grants are playing a crucial role in sustaining people's lives. And so I'm battling to comprehend what you're actually saying there. Thanks very much.
In this page, can I end with Ms. Makoto, and then I'll take the next page, which is Ms. Sabida, Mr. Jonathan, Mr. Sheikh, or Mr. Sogoni, Mr. Fabs. That will plunge us 1 hour behind already. Okay. Ms. Makoto, yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. Good morning. I just want to rebut to the question raised by Mr. Schneemann with regard to the grants. I want to check, what are you suggesting? Are we suggesting that we should change the social policy of South Africa? Because like research has been done to assess the effectiveness of those grants. And in my own view, and also the outcomes of those research have also asserted that women are the best and effective users of social grants. So I want to suggest, I want to ask a question, what is it that you are suggesting that we do as South Africa? Because also you don't make a clear comparison with other countries like you have done in terms of education, where you find that the pregnancy levels in South Africa do not necessarily are not necessarily above those in other countries, developing countries. Maybe there must be a comparison that is done so that we are able to illustrate the problem that you are highlighting much better. And the next question I will ask to Mr. Balim. You talked about the ratings of South Africa. I want to check what weights do they use in order to determine the ratings that Standard and Poor and Fitch are making. And then just to check whether they are not similar these ratings are not controlled by the same, like, are not speculative, like you have the exchange currency speculators, you know, which will once in a while come and do their own speculation based on, you know, small issues that might arise within the country. Thank you.
Can we have responses perhaps in the same order that we presented so that we have a particular order? Starting with Mr. Lokshay, if there are questions directed at you, if you could just deal with
them. Chair, I'm not quite sure which questions were actually directed to me personally. There was, and I'm not going to try to reply to each and every one of these questions. But if I can just make a few points in response to some of the questions. Although the question was addressed to Mr. Rudy and he asked for it by his comments on the grant, I just want to make the point that I don't know whether you're aware of, there's some academic research that's been done on the effect of grants, speaking specifically of very extensive work that's been done by academics at the University of Stellenbosch, Professor Safas van der Berg and his colleagues, indicating that indeed the grants have made a difference as far as poverty alleviation is concerned. However, I just want to connect that to a statement in the economic policy proposals that was adopted by the ANC at the Polokwane conference, which says South Africa doesn't want to be a welfare state. And then it makes the point that sort of there's no glory in having a large number of people dependent on social grants. What we should focus on is to create escape routes. The social grants, that's a safety net, but in the end we want people to escape from having to be dependent on social grants. And that means things like having an effective, efficient education system, giving people good education, improving the health system because only healthy people can be productive, infrastructure development, particularly, let's say, for example, in rural areas and so on. So I just thought I wanted to add that perspective. As far as the Alliance Summit is concerned and the 5 million jobs, I don't see a plan there, actually, to say exactly how we're going to get 5 million jobs. I think we must be careful in South Africa that we create these goals that we set ourselves, and then we don't make it, and then we say, okay, but we've now failed. But the failure was actually right at the beginning in setting ourselves goals which are not always feasible. And I can go right back to gear, for example, in terms of the goals that was set there, but then achieving those goals, there's assumptions made in the process. One of the assumptions, for example, in that case, was on capital inflows equating to 4% of GDP annual. And so if you don't get the capital, then you can't also make the goal. So I think we must be careful. I would hope we can create more than 5 million jobs, but I don't see the plan actually to get how we get to that exact number. Comment on the market reaction perhaps to the medium-term budget policy statement, that question. I think at Tuesday afternoon when the minister delivered his speech, there were other forces that were much, much more important in pushing around the exchange rate than the medium-term budget policy statement. I wouldn't interpret the weakening of the rand late Tuesday afternoon at all to the minister then having put his foot wrong. The pattern over the past week has been that the U.S. markets opened at our time about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's almost every day you can see after 4, there's a sudden weakening in both our equities and also in the currency. It's selling out of New York. I showed you that some, I think there's indiscriminate selling over a broad range of assets. If the budget policy statement played a role on Tuesday, then I would say perhaps in highlighting the current account deficit, and in that forecast, the current account deficit is not going to improve over the next couple of years, it's actually going to get worse. That perhaps could have made a difference. But if that's what your forecast shows, that's what it shows. The only way to have countered that would have been to say no, but we're going to be much more conservative in our infrastructure spending. And I'm not sure that that would have been the right way to go. Perhaps I should stop there and then give my colleagues the opportunity also.
Okay, Mr. Valle.
Thank you. The remarks surrounding the fact that we're exposed to the G7 nations in terms of a fair share of our exports, roughly a third of our exports go to the G7 nations, and of course the implication because of their pronounced weakness that it's going to be a headwind, and the remark that we only ship 5% of our exports to the BRIC countries, which seemingly are still growing firmly. How do we protect ourselves? And I think you asked about diversification. Firstly, do we engage with the world or do we be insular? And I think in that respect there is no real choice. We have to engage with the world. We have to establish umbilical cords with and be an open society in terms of our trade regime. What that implies is that when the tide comes in, our boat rises as well, and that has been experienced over the last couple of years. Unfortunately, the tide is going out. It's going out in mass, and our boat, along with the boats of emerging markets and the G7, G10 nations, is also going out, so everybody is drifting lower. I would just add the caveat, even though emerging markets will still grow firmly, 6-7% in real terms, even though China is growing 9% in real terms, the point is not the absolute growth rate and the veneer of rapid pace. These economies are slowing markedly. There is a meaningful momentum loss in these economies. It's like a vehicle going at 120 kilometers an hour to 80 kilometers an hour. In that is recessionary risk. So the first point I would say is that we don't suddenly withdraw and attempt to shield ourselves from the external environment. We've got to participate and play it like a football game with great defenses. The defenses are in the capacity for individuals, firms, and the government to smooth its expenditure profile during bad times. So maybe I would say very colloquially, to run a country, to run personal finance, and to run a firm in a manner where bad things just don't happen to other people, but they happen to me and you and all of us as well. So that means we should tend towards building buffer stock. Some nations call it reserves, foreign currency reserves, so as to help build external defenses so that they can intervene and defend their currency if it needs be. The South African Reserve Bank is doing that. The same transmission system or the same fundamental ideological logic has been built public finances. The Minister Manuel has been boosting his public sector purse in terms of the fiscal surpluses and the general contribution to national savings, so that in times of distress, like now, he can inject or engage his defense systems and introduce contra-cyclical fiscal policy of some measure without capitulating, without compromising the overall integrity of public finances. However, the weakness inherent in the overall sort of multi-party, counterparty architecture is households and individuals. Massive dissavings over the last couple of years. And admittedly, we're in a period of time where we're going through a transformative phase, and there is a hunger for people not to be reckless, not to be wasteful, but they're buying houses, they're buying first-time cars, they're buying first-time durable goods. There is a challenge in the sense that people are buying durable goods items that are core items. We're not talking about big-screen TVs, but we're talking about very basic electrical appliances. The people you know, can purchase with on credit. And that is the tension we face, an aspirant consumer dynamic that is going to be levered on finance. And it's a struggle when the finance or the price of money rises by 40% over the pace of 2 years. So that part of the solution also comes in that households, and especially novice borrowers, right, need to increase their degree of financial literacy. And maybe financial institutions need to guide people in terms of, you know, tail risks, as we call it, broadside risks that can imbue or impact on your personal finances. So I would just say that you spoke about diversification. Yes, diversification is good because it effectively smooths your trade profile. I would highlight to you, just quickly, sorry not to monopolize the time, EM to EM trade, south-south trade, today accounts for roughly 50% of global trade, up from 30%, 32% in fact in 1990. EM to advanced economy trade has fallen from about 63% to around 45%. So attach yourself to the EM economies because they're going to be more spirited. Very quickly, what are the opportunities that come out of this? You know, the point of when the tide goes out, chips are rising, chips are all drifting. The opportunity is not in the terms of how do the vultures kind of prepare themselves or how do the vultures participate. It's more coming to my first point about defensiveness in what is a very small open economy, so that we're able to simply counter, you know, downward swings in the global tide and harness opportunities over and above average during the upside. During a rising tide. I won't necessarily speak to the RAND. I think Mr. Lopesha spoke well to that. The question about the Millennium Development Goals and will we get there by 2014? I think that the promise of 5 million jobs and the promise of, you know, halving unemployment, which is really getting into 14% by 2014 from the 28% in 2004, in my view, is going to be fit. It's fetched. I just don't think that, consider this, that over the last 5 years, never before, has so many benefited by so much in such a short period of time. Never before has the world enjoyed such a benign period of growth and the propensity, the ability for individuals to be moving up the durable goods curve, moving up the income chain towards middle income, moving up the protein chain and so forth. And I fear that it is going to be a return to more trend world economic growth over the next at least three or four years, and the flightiness that we've seen. In South Africa, I think that despite a very large unemployment rate, we were very brisk. In fact, I would say we excelled in employment creation over the last 4 or 5 years, and we're not going to replicate that over the next 5 years. To begin with. It only means that the tail end of that sort of, nearing 2014, it makes it so much harder. And already we've seen less than 100,000 jobs being created sort of on an annualized basis in the recent quarters. Finally, the question with respect to the credit rating agencies, how do they appraise us? You know, the first question they would ask a country, a sovereign, which is very much the same question a bank asks an individual applying for a loan, is affordability. Do they have the capacity to fund their debts out of their income? And the second question is the will to pay that. So it's the capability, the capacity, and the willingness to pay that. And so the bulk of the question is answered by appraising financial health. Has the state got enough revenue? Is it generating enough revenue sustainably? And if there were broadside shocks, can they still continue to meet their payments? So it's affordability question, and it then transcends the state. It covers all types of borrowers, right? So that is where the crux of it. Embracing that ability to pay, the rating agencies will ask questions like, what is the political ideology, the political constitution? Is it one that, for example, and I'm not at all implying that this is what is going to happen, is it going to be a state where there's suddenly going to be substantial shift to demanding excessive and unsustainable social welfare payments, where it raises the fiscal deficit, the debt-to-GDP ratios, where it's at the margin that the state can meet its payments, and a mild shock to public finances means that it can't, and that compromises the capacity to pay, let alone the willingness to pay. So it's really within the realm of public finances and all of the political and broad policy choices that embrace public finances, that imbues the credit rating agencies. If I can maybe just, I think, conclude, and I maybe want to be contentious and not deliberately counter Darby, I don't think South Africa is poor. I think South Africa is pretty rich. The challenge to my mind is quite simply a redistribution of that wealth. And I think the core challenge for us as a citizenry over a multi-decade horizon is quite simply this. 8 out of every 10 South Africans you will meet are black African, South African. And that collective capture only receives half of South Africa's income, right? Whereas the established community comprises roughly 1 in 10 South Africans, but enjoys roughly 40% of national income. And if you take it away from income, and you also maybe look at it as balance sheet, wealth, it's even more disparate in terms of its distribution. With established community, 10% of the population claims about 80% of South Africa's wealth in the form of real estate assets or financial assets. So I think the question is not so much of being poor, but rebalancing it in a non-populist, non-destructive way in terms of financial, the redistribution element of public finances, and also not destroying individuals' want and will to work in South Africa because the incentive to work is simply taxed harshly. And that's the balance, I think, as a society we struggle to find. But I'll conclude there. Thank you.
Mr. Roach.
Thank you, sir. Gulam, maybe if I can just, you're absolutely right. I'm not trying to disagree with you. The point I was trying to make is that, and I think what you are doing at the moment, you're taking a snapshot, and what you should be doing is look at the video, and the video will tell you there were significant changes the last couple of years. And that's exactly what I showed in my analysis of the redistributional impact of the fiscus. There was in the currently indeed is a huge redistributional. I'm not criticizing that. And again, I'm the messenger here. Let me just go through some of the questions, if I may, sir. The question about inflation, sir. I've had a look, and I don't have the slide here with me, so you just have to believe me if you don't mind, sir. And that is, I've compared South Africa the rate or what ratio, to what extent we miss our inflation targets, and I compare that to our inflation targets, and I looked at that with the two other economies. And South Africa is not the highest. We don't miss our inflation target by the highest, but we are one of the highest, firstly. Secondly, South Africa's inflation targets are also relatively high. So we have high targets, and we're missing it with a much larger margin than most economies. Secondly, sir, food prices is not the reason why we have inflation. Oil prices is not the reason why we have inflation. Increase in food prices or oil prices is never inflationary. Inflationary is not an event. Inflation is always a process, and that process needs money to go on. And there is no short-term or long-term choice between inflation and economic growth. High or low inflation does not guarantee economic growth. High inflation guarantees low economic growth. Now, my criticism on the Reserve Bank is more criticism of degree. I agree with what the Reserve Bank has done. I agree they should have lowered interest rates in the cycle, and I agree they should have increased interest rates. But my criticism is more of degree. Like, I think they lowered it too much. I think they fell too close to the wind, and they didn't increase enough. So it's more a degree criticism than actually criticizing the Reserve Bank's actions. I think they acted correctly, but just not enough. So it's more, if I came over of too critical in the Reserve Bank, that was not the intention, but I think it could have been a little bit more tighter. Opportunities for South Africa, there was a lot, my colleague here touched on that quite nicely. I don't know what's going to happen in the rest of the world, but we were speculating yesterday about something. In the last couple of, say, 20 years, what we have had is the U.S. economy particularly, or specifically, driving the world economy by consuming just a massive amount of everything, the U.S. economy. And that was a driving force of the world economy, this consumption in the United States. And everybody, including South Africa, exported, and we all fed this monster. They wanted to consume, and we sold to them, and the Chinese as well. Now that huge consumption monster is going to come to an end, and they're going to go through a difficult time, the United States. What is likely to happen? I don't really know, but the possibility is that we could see the Chinese economy slowly turning into a real consumer economy as well. They want to have chicken and they want to have microwaves and all that, and that could be the saving grace of the world economy maybe over a year or two, three, four. And maybe that is an opportunity for South Africa. That is something that maybe we could tap into. Whether they maybe will they will do a Japanese trick on the rest of us. The Japanese went into a slowdown in consumption the last 20 years or whatever. That could also happen, but I think that is a possibility, that whereby the Chinese, the contribution to the world economy, the Chinese and the Indians, was by way of lower production costs, low wages coming into the world economy. Now their contribution could be by way of starting to consume more. What is the competitive exchange rate? Will this 24 billion help? 24 billion, so it's just more taxes. I just want to say, of course, you can spend the money now, but someone's got to pay for it somewhere. What is the competitive exchange rate? I don't know where it is. I think where it is now is pretty competitive. 11 to the US is very, very competitive, and I think we'll start seeing that in the current account also sometime. Yes, I have to agree with Mr. Lashia on the reaction by the market. I think it was just coincidence that the market reacted negatively on the day or shortly after the minister's speech on the medium term. We have to remember, the reason why the rand came under pressure is a simple exercise. We consume more than what we produce, and the foreigners have been putting money in South Africa for a long time now. Now they're just taking the money out because they want to use their own money. They're in trouble themselves. So they take the money away from us. Not because they don't necessarily like us, but because they want to use the money self. That's one reason. And there's some risk issues as well. But I think maybe that a contributing reason is the fact that we're probably going to go into a fiscal deficit. And a fiscal deficit means that you need more capital to fund fiscal expenditure. And maybe that was a slight contributing reason. But I have to agree with Mr. Lapshaw that that was not the main reason why the rand came under pressure. It was to do with international capital. And then the economic summit, the ANC, 50% unemployment. That's going to be a tough one. All right, on the grants, I've been a few comments about the grants. I think the grants, and I have to agree with Mr. Locha, was a huge reduction in real poverty in South Africa, and that's mainly because of the grants. So I'm very, very much in favor of the grants, don't misunderstand me, especially the old age grant. But I want to tell you a story of what happened to me one day. I was in Oudtshoorn, and two things happened to me in Oudtshoorn. And I don't say this is always the case. We've done some regressions on some other numbers, and I can give you that as well. But I want to tell you the story that I saw my own eyes. On the day of the grant payout, it's called All Pay. That's the name of it, All Pay. And on All Pay, very few people work. Whether you've got a job or not, everybody go in a plot line, go to the town and get their grant. And one specific day, it was a hot summer day, I drove out of town, out of Oudtshoorn, and there was a young girl walking in the dirt road with a pop sock in her hand. And I don't know where she comes from, and maybe I'm wrong, but it was an All Pay, and she was seriously drunk with this pop sock of wine in her hand. And a couple of steps behind her was a little boy running after, which I thought was obviously his mother. And he was crying, snot and tram. So what it looked to me is that she got the grant for a child, and she didn't use it for the child, she used it to buy a pop sock. Now, I'm not against giving a grant to children, but I think what we need to do, we have to somehow fine-tune this. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe, instead of giving money to this girl, she's a young girl, she was, I don't know, 18, 19 years old, maybe there could be some other structure. Maybe we can channel the money through a preschool, creche kind of system. Because that money doesn't end up with the children quite often. Another example, there's also an Oudtshoorn, there's a young boy. He's got four girlfriends. And all four girlfriends of his got babies. And every month he will come and collect half the child support grant from each one of his girlfriends. There's a joke that he's an entrepreneur, he wants to get a good return on his deposit. So, but that is one of those unintended consequences. I don't know how to address that, but we have to address it. South Africa is not so wealthy, and whenever we decide to spend money on things like poverty alleviation and helping the really poor, let's do whatever we can to make sure that the money really ends up with the really poor. So I'm not against grants if that was the intention or that was the impression. That is certainly not the case. What I'm trying to say is, please, let's use this resource as well as we possibly can, and don't let it lead to unintended consequences that could be quite negative quite often.
Look, members, I don't know. I'm sitting with five more hands. We're already 30 minutes into the time for the others. We're supposed to have broken for tea, and we did not, because I thought we would have dealt with these three presenters. I know it's an important engagement. It's just not a good time for me on a Friday. I know members just now would want to leave, and if we prolong it, I'm going to be the only one sitting here, and I don't want to do that. So I've got Sibila, I've got Johnson, I've got Mashiko, I've got Sogoni has left, I've got Ms. Fabs. First, let me check if, I mean, there are any withdrawals. Thank you, Ms. Sibila. Okay, no other. Okay, Mr. Johnson. And can I reduce the take now to one question, because I'm no prefix and no...
One question.
Yeah. The one that you think, if you don't ask it. We're going to have tea with the presenters, and we'll still
engage with them. Let me be on my very last one, which is a comment, Chair. Okay. I won't ask questions. The simple comment, Chair, I wanted to make is that I think you have a very good economist in Mr. Wood, but I think he really goes overboard when he insults. And he goes equally to becoming very cynical in his economic way of presenting himself. And lastly, Chair, you do not have a person like him, I would imagine, coming to Parliament having no jacket. I think that shows a very serious disrespect to an institution called Parliament. Let me make that comment. Thanks.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a dress code for presenters. We have a dress code for members of parliament. But, points taken. Member Shekho. I did not see you indicating that you are withdrawing. Thanks. You know, most of the points that have been raised, I think they assist us in actually furthering our debate on these matters, because these are views we really need to hear, because if we don't hear them, then we'll be making a serious mistake, because it would mean we haven't got a representative view of society and the economic world out there. Ms. Fabs, are you not withdrawing?
No, mine is very short. I think you know why I'm saying thank you so much. Oh, that's not very fun.
No, you know, Chair, I'm being sabotaged. Yeah. Sorry about that, Chairperson. A very short one, but it does cover both presentations. I wasn't here for the economist Loebscher's, but I read the document. I was here for part of yours, Mr. Darby. Right. It's referring to the public finances and the current empty BPS. There's a statement in this particular one from Mr. Jacques Loebscher about the, he looks at two scenarios in the empty BPS, and then the inference seems to be that the Minister of Finance's empty BPS that he's drawn up collectively with Cabinet is far too optimistic considering the current scenario. And that seems to take account of also what was being said here under the public finances facing under-delivery risk. Now, the question I'm asking, in view of the responses we've already had, is I've studied this document, and it does seem to make the same points that you're making about the current environment internationally. But notwithstanding what you've said, is it not a reality that internationally they are saying that to an extent emerging markets will not face quite the same pressures as the United States, Eurozone, and some of the Asian markets? And yet you make the statement, notwithstanding it would seem, some of the comments that have already been made internationally. And I in no way am discounting the current crisis that we are facing. But we've already said our economy is not export-led entirely, which is where the huge problem is. Thank you.
A quick response. If one of you can speak on behalf of all three of you.
Yeah, Chair, if I can respond quickly. Firstly, I just want to make the point, it's not an inference. If you go to the budget policy statement, page 12, the two scenarios are described there, and the last sentence is, our current economic forecast reflects this more benign set of assumptions. Now, given the uncertainty at the moment about forecast, especially 2 and 3 years out, I don't have any better forecast to suggest, so I'm not critical at all of the approach, I must say, that was taken. Secondly, as far as emerging markets versus others are concerned, I pointed out in the presentation that the developed countries, many of them will probably have experienced a classical recession in the sense of a decline in GDP, whereas emerging market countries are more likely to have growth recessions. In other words, still positive growth, but lower than previously. So I think that ties in with your suggestion. Coming back to the first point, that, as I said, I think one must be realistic that as far as the budget that was put on the table, the risks are unfortunately to the downside. I don't think there was leeway at all for a more optimistic budget to be put forward. If I can briefly just mention two things. Mr. Balin pointed out the structural deficit that will now go to about 2% of GDP. But just two other parameters also. With the current account deficit of 8% of GDP, government can't dissave. And that was a constraint, therefore, government saving remains positive, but there's not much room there to move. The second point I just briefly want to make is the primary balance. The primary balance next year, in other words, that's non-interest expenditure compared to revenue, will be close to zero. Very little has to go wrong before you end up in a negative primary balance. In other words, you start borrowing money to pay interest. That was my starting comment, was to say that it was an exercise in the art of the possible. There's lots of things that one would like to have seen done, but there's no room. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much. I'm sorry to cut you short, but we definitely have to move on. It would, if we had time, it would have been very interesting to engage with some of the points. I see Mr. Johnson is a bit... I think Mr. Lloyd raised a number of very provocative things. You know, the issue of keeping bankrupt companies alive. You know, it would have been very good to know what exactly do we do with parastatals, that are bankrupt. And, we would have gone on. The issue of the tax comparisons with other countries. We sit here with the document that National Treasury keeps on. When we respond to that, National Treasury tables a document which we've taken as the gospel truth. We would have gone into quite a debate. It was going to be interesting, but unfortunately. But one of the things we have said we're going to do is to set up a day where we're going to look at especially the issue of the global meltdown. We had said we would want to have an engagement with the department, with the National Treasury, with the Bank Supervision Division, with the Financial Services Board, so that we look at where we stand with regards both to the contagion of the situation but also as to our situation inside as to what is happening. Maybe we need to structure it in such a way that we also have economists also talking to that so that we have a broader debate. Maybe we should dedicate a day to that. And it would be interesting to invite these distinguished gentlemen. Your comparison of misplaced targets, unemployment and entrepreneurship, poverty and wealth, cars and roads, food prices and food production, with some of which I agree with, but, you know, I would have loved a debate on some of these things. You want to say something quickly?
Please, sir, if I may, I think it seems to me as if we are reaching the end of the meeting, and I just thought to say that I was not aware of a specific dress code, and that was certainly not meant to be disrespectful, sir, so my humble apologies if you... for my dress code. I will make sure that in future that I will be appropriately dressed. So I'm sorry about that, sir. And I also try not to be cynical. I try to be as objective as I possibly can. If there are a list of things, sir, in future that you don't want me to say, I will keep that in mind as well. But about the dress code, I'm certainly sorry.
Yeah.
So that's the last thing
we'll do to you. Works for me. Good day, and it's all yours. Tough,
thank you, Chair. I'm going to make this presentation very short because we're representing interests of workers here. We're not economists. Every year we get shoved with the economists, and it's very intimidating to sit and listen to them. Producer is very want to commend the minister on the concise budget statement that we've done. We believe the government is facing serious challenges from abroad and domestically. We noted that in the 2008 budget, beginning of the year. The challenge from the fiscal side for the next 3 years is to counteract the adverse effects of the external challenges, the banking and the credit crisis on developing countries. For us as producers, it's important how all of this is affecting workers, ordinary workers, people in employment out there, people trying to make a living. This year was... The MTBPS was prepared against the background of the banking and the credit crisis. It will affect our economic growth rate negatively. It will obviously have an effect of a lower export demand, financial volatility, exchange rate turbulence, and uncertain expectations, and also the possibility of huge, huge unemployment, companies having to close down, retrenchments. We're already seeing that in the SME sector, and it's really very alarming. Producer agree with the Minister that in the light of the global economic challenges ahead, special attention needs to be given to lift our rate of national savings, to construct a more export-orientated economy, and to create a more labour-intensive growth trajectory. However, ordinary members on the ground are bleeding. Consumer price inflation increased during 2008 because of higher food and fuel prices. The minister is of the opinion in his document that the inflation target is more promising than economic rate. I can tell you, from a federation perspective out there, the members are bleeding. They are losing houses, they are losing cars, they are just cutting on all expenses because they can hardly afford at this stage to live. In terms of the economic challenges for the 2008 MTBPS, we believe, first of all, the primary economic challenge would be obviously the global economic climate. And then, how do you reduce unemployment and rising poverty in a time such as this? We agree with the minister there's a decline of foreign demand, weaker prices, etc., and it will have an increase on the economic growth rate. However, for producers from a fiscal point of view, we believe that the millions of primary low skills of Africans currently wanting work is its major challenge to address, and we need the government to address that. There are some measures through the EPWP, Expanded Public Works Programs, to deal with low skills, that remains a major hurdle to advancement of growth and development, and therefore we believe that's a major issue that needs to be addressed in terms of fiscal policy. We agree with the fiscal stance on the longer term. Although the budget balance will be in a deficit over the MTBP period, government will contribute to national savings as the growth in per capita spending will exceed the growth in recurrent expenditure. A fiscal balance of less than 2% is acceptable given the current challenges. And we basically agree with the fiscal framework for the 2009 period, taking into account the slower economic growth and the need to support continued infrastructure investment and social development in a context of more certainty. However, if we look at specific budget allocations in the three-year spending priorities, there's one or two concerns. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to highlight the concerns to you. I'm not going to highlight the areas where we disagree. In terms of tabled legislation, there was a finance bill, which we've welcomed. We've given input in terms of that to the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, input in terms of this committee on the money bill. We believe that's quite important. We believe there's several additional allocations included in the Justice Appropriation Bill. It's also very important to deal with challenges being faced in society. Specific issues that need to be mentioned, there is one, the 2.5 billion rand allocated to the Road Accident Fund, which is currently dragging its feet and not paying victims of road accidents. Now, there was supposed to be a major overhaul. Since June this year, minimal payments are being done. No settlements are taking place, and there's no payment payout since June. 2.5 billion rand has been allocated, and we believe and hope that this will change the nature of payouts, because the people that are suffering are the road users, people utilizing taxis, public transport, that are involved in accidents, and therefore claim for some of these injuries. What's also important to us is the school nutrition programs, the extension of that. However, how it gets rolled out is very important and how it affects children in the end of the day. We welcome the 5 billion for higher salaries due to high inflation and the 2.2 billion for high inflated rates adjustments to cover the cost of fuel, textbooks, medicines, and medical equipment, and also the inflation-related adjustments to the social grants. We are, however, a bit skeptical when we saw the 2.5 billion rand recommended in the Adjustment Appropriation Bill as a once-off allocation for the political office bearers' pension fund. It would have been nice if this pension fund allocation would have been extended, would have been used to extend the social grant to utilize it for those people that fall outside of that 14 to 16 year category. And maybe by extending it, you could utilize that money more useful, and that would be our submission. The short-term interventions introduced by government in raising the value of the old age grant, the social grant, the disability grant, and the care dependency grant as poverty relievers are welcomed so that they don't have to wait until April. Unfortunately, fiduciary believe that this money will just get eaten up by inflation. Unfortunately, 40 rand would most probably have been a better allocation for that, but we consider the limitations in terms of the budget. We welcome the additional resources for the school feeding programs, the agricultural starter packs. What we would like to see is more training taking place and more skills being placed, specifically in the agricultural sector, increasing the no-fee schooling is welcomed. The additional allocation for health sector is also welcomed. I'm not going to go into details there because our workers on the floor agree with that. Producer and our National Executive Council are preparing for a National Congress on the 6th and 7th November. We've identified the resolution to ensure resources are allocated to expand investment in agriculture, which is currently very slow. We welcome the policy direction with a view to extending extension services and providing better support for small-scale farmers and increasing investment in housing, roads, and other economic infrastructure. In order for us to overcome our food crisis, we need to get food production up, and we believe that such programs, such as allocations done by the minister, will hopefully go a long way in assisting with this. We also believe that the additional resources to the municipal sphere to cover the higher cost of providing free basic services and also the municipal infrastructure grant will accelerate the provision of basic services and that this will assist in poverty alleviation. However, bureaucracy and red tape to getting those services also needs to be addressed. In conclusion, we would just like to say that there's serious challenges being faced, and we commend the Minister in the way in which he steers and harness the budget to steer through these few difficult years. We also need to remember that fiscal policy has to be coordinated with monetary policy. Otherwise, one policy may counteract or negate the effects of other type of policy. It's for this reason that we request that the National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank interact with social partners in the Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber in NEDLAC to ensure that there's a close liaison between National Treasury, which is responsible for the execution of fiscal policy, and the South African Reserve Bank, who apply the monetary policy in South Africa. We've done some of these submissions in our manual submission, and looking at the new draft, the bill that's been agreed to, we believe there is still some consultation in terms of that. But overall, we believe that it's a good budget. Thank you, Chair. Short.
Thank you. Busa, Business Unity South Africa. Advocate, you thought you were still going on. No, you want to just shift a bit so that, you know, the two can make their presentation and we'll take we'll take questions together. We won't keep you. I see Busa has also prepared a very short submission. I'm told that the first, I don't know which one came first, but there are two submissions. I don't know which one you're going to be talking to. But Busa is represented by Advocate Meiring and Ms. Suisa. It's up to you how you handle it, but tell us which one you're talking to.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the invitation once again from this committee for organized business to give input on the medium-term budget policy statement. As you know, we regard this as an important opportunity to get the overall business view also on the table of Parliament. And we believe that in the new role that Parliament is also going to play with your enhanced responsibilities in terms of the money bill legislation going through, that this is an important opportunity for an overall business view. For the sake of time, we will keep our presentation today very short. We will first deal with an economic overview, and Ms. Suisa, who is heading our economic policy desk at Busa, will deal with that, whereafter I will deal with a short overview on the aspects covered in Chapter 4 of the medium-term budget policy statement, namely those relating to tax policy. So without further ado, the document that is headed BUSA is the one that Mr. Visa will deal with now on the economic overview.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, as BUSA, we appreciate the opportunity once again to appear before this committee. We also appreciate the opportunity of listening to the panelists in their submissions. It is not our intention to repeat what they've said, but rather we would like to highlight principal issues as we try as South Africans to deal with the current global environment as well as our challenging domestic environment. Just from the onset, I would like to state that we do agree with the Minister of Finance. The storm has indeed arrived. It is fiercer than anyone would have expected, and as Jacques Lobsha said this morning, no one can state with certainty how long it will be around for. I think under the current environment, we need to focus our attention on our stated economic policy objectives. This is not the time for us to depart from what's worked. This is the time for us to say, how can we strengthen our economic policy environment so that we're better insulated going forward? Chairperson, we as BUSA would like to state on record that we believe that the prudent fiscal and monetary policy decisions taken by this government over the past decade have really assisted in insulating the South African economy from the current turbulence. In particular, the introduction of the structural budget framework last year has assisted in smoothing out our fiscal policy expenditure. It is interesting to read that in Nigeria, for example, where they were looking at the current boom in commodity prices, they had budgeted based on a $200 per barrel oil prices. And as a result of the downturn, they would have had to revise their expenditure. Now, in South Africa, we are fortunate because our government and this committee has been prudent enough such that we do not have to revise our expenditure, and our people will not suffer as a result of that. I think we need to continue on being innovative. We need to continue on researching best practice. And indeed, the National Treasury, this committee, and our government have made significant strides in that regard. BUSA also welcomes a reassurance that we were given by the Minister of Finance on the stability of our banking and financial sectors, especially under the current environment. It is our view that an optimal regulatory regime must balance self-regulation with prudent regulation by government and regulators. Such structure is optimal because it reduces what we call information asymmetry between the financial sector and regulators. It is true that the complexity of the financial markets means that in most instances, the regulators might not be aware of the true extent of the actual dealings within the particular business or the particular industry. Now, in South Africa, we've obviously gone a long way with implementation of Basel II. We've gone a long way in our domestic regulation as well, the NCA, and other relevant legislation. But I think what the current environment reminds us is that we are interconnected to the global financial markets. It also reminds us to focus on systemic stability. We need to ensure that whatever policy decisions we take do not compromise the systemic challenges that we have. The banks have a particular role that they play in our economy as agents of liquidity. And without banks, we will struggle to get the necessary economic growth that we require for development and obviously improving the lives of our people, which is an objective as South Africans are committed to. Honourable Chair, once again, the MTBPS continued along an established path. It assisted business and South Africans to refocus energies on where we're going. We are now much more clearer of what government will do, and we understand what responsibilities we have as South Africans to contribute towards the midterm goals of this country. But I think I'd like to really focus on the issues of the current slowdown. I know the previous panelists referred to the revisions in economic growth, but in our view, what the current slowdown forces us to do is to really look at our domestic situation. We need to focus on increasing productivity, increasing our global competitiveness, because it is only through that that we can create new jobs, we can create new industries, and ensure that when the business cycle turns, we're able to maximize on the benefits of global trade as well as financial flows. Now, honorable members, as you might know, the World Economic Forum every year does a global competitiveness survey, which measures the competitiveness of 134 economies. In the current year, South Africa was ranked 45 out of 134 countries, and we were the best in Africa. However, this must remind us that we need to be the best in the world. There are some areas within that index that are very, very concerning. In our primary and secondary education, we were ranked 102 out of 134. Our health facilities were also ranked poorly. Such surveys are a useful indicator that we must invest in human capital. And as a result, at BUSA, we're very encouraged by the allocations given to primary health care as well as education in general. We also believe that it is important for us to focus our energy on stimulating the SME sector. They are responsible for 30% at the current level of GDP growth. And they also encourage the entrance of new players into the economy. So they are a useful instrument in as far as the redistribution is concerned. And that, in our view, whilst this is not a national treasury or even a portfolio committee issue, our government should focus on that as well. What are the bottlenecks that frustrate progress and development of SMEs? Honourable members, at BUSA, we support any initiative that will enhance economic growth in South Africa. And I think as we move forward, we mustn't lose focus on economic growth. But when you pursue economic growth, you must understand that we don't pursue economic growth for its own sake. We are pursuing it because it is the only way that we can achieve our stated objectives of having unemployment and poverty. It is indeed difficult times for us as a country and around the world. But I think the key issue is how do we ensure that the micro challenges that frustrate service delivery at local government, at provincial government level, are removed urgently, because it is not the fiscal allocations that determine how we proceed as a country, but how the ability of the state to actually implement the budgeting allocations. Honourable Chair, as BUSA, we are willing and we are availing ourselves to work with this committee, to work with other structures through NEDLAC in the Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber, as the previous speaker referred to deal with the current challenges and to ensure that going forward there is vigorous debate on the regulation of the financial sector, on the regulation of our banks, on how the priorities of this country are set and how we can work together as social partners to ensure that we meet our objectives and we ensure that the benefits of economic growth are shared amongst all our people. Thank you.
Thanks, Advocate Miller.
Thank you, Chair. This part of our presentation will deal with the tax policy aspects of the medium-term budget policy statement. It is in a document under the heading of the Business Parliamentary Office, which are in the practice, honourable members.
Okay.
I'll be very short. It's a two-pager. Essentially, what we're doing here, Chair, is to point out to some issues in the tax environment, the tax policy environment, which we believe should be on the agenda of Parliament as the legislature. Let me first of all say, in my capacity as Chairman of the Business Parliamentary Office, that we welcome the nature of this year's Chapter 4 to the medium-term budget policy statement. Members will recall that last year, this particular chapter omitted the normal overview of the implementation of tax policy, which has become a feature of the medium-term budget policy statement, and we are very heartened to see that we have returned to the previous levels of transparency with the chapter now including an overview of the implementation of tax policy in the 2008 budget. This makes for great transparency, which we are a strong advocate of. In the current environment of global upheaval and local political change, it's even more important that there is transparency around everything we do on the financial side and particularly also on the tax side. There are three issues I'd like to cover as far as macro tax policy are concerned, and they're listed on page one of our submission. The tax to GDP ratio, tax reform, and what I call tax competitiveness. Our committee, the BUSA-SACI Tax Committee, has taken great interest, as members will recall from past submissions, in the tax-to-GDP ratio in this country, rising from 22.8% in 94-95, breaching the 25% level in 25-26, and now standing at more than 27%. We believe that the underlying forces for this, what Davi Roet called this morning massive increase in overall the tax burden, has to a large extent also been the result of sustainable factors. One of those is the broadening of the tax base, and the other very important one is better tax administration. We believe those were sustainable changes and that they are now firmly entrenched in our tax system, which is hugely positive. As a result thereof, BUSA is looking forward to an overall stabilization of the tax burden. And it's also very encouraging to see that that is what the medium-term budget policy statement foresees, maybe stabilizing around 26% in the medium term. As far as tax reform is concerned, Chair, there is no doubt that the past decade has been a decade of more or less continuous tax reform. This committee has often been tasked with voluminous revenue laws and fiscal amendment bills, and we're all aware of the massive changes around capital gains tax moving from a source to a residence basis and the like. Some of these very important changes, like the move from a secondary tax on companies to a dividend withholding tax, is still being bedded down. This is a volatile environment. It's also an environment where BUSA would like to see a period of consolidation to counter the complexity that goes hand in hand with new forms of taxation. We therefore noted with some concern the statement on page 40 of the medium-term budget policy statement, where it is stated, I quote, that further tax instruments to fund local governments are being investigated. We know the reason for the abolition of the Regional Services Council levies, and one would hope that we are not going to have new local government taxes, which is again going to introduce the complexity that actually made the RSC levies not a good tax, and one of the reasons why we got rid of it, despite the 7 billion rand decision that went with that.
As far as tax competitiveness is concerned, this is a concept, Chair, which is inherent in overall country competitiveness, which my colleague has already referred to, and where this country stands. It is particularly also important in an era where foreign direct investment in emerging economies like our own is likely to be at a premium going forward. Mindful of the legitimate concerns that there often are about the race to the bottom, as the Minister of Finance, the Honourable Minister of Finance, has from time to time called this, and I think rightly so, and mindful also of the fact that there's a fickleness in providing tax incentives to draw capital to the shores of a particular country, we still believe that the current environment calls for a substantive investigation, and I would suggest personally even maybe a commission of inquiry to deeply look into the competitiveness of investing with the aim of doing business, in other words, not portfolio investing, but investing with the aim of doing business in South Africa and out of South Africa. It is a source of concern, Chair, that every year when we get right down to the nitty-gritty of the income tax bill and we sit with National Treasury, as we again did this year, in debating issues around, for example, the secondary tax on companies, that there are private sector input given, which clearly shows that this country is a difficult place for foreign investors to really get excited about. We must get to the bottom of this and become a winning, competitive nation. There is no better time than to become that than now, when foreign flows are going to be at a huge premium. The private sector, and no doubt international firms, would be able to assist in us arriving at this point. Dealing now with three last issues, Chair, the corporate income tax has been on our agenda, understandably, for many years. It's already been pointed out this morning that there's been a significant increase in the relevant contribution from 10.5% in 2000 to more than 25% currently. We believe that this is on the basis of significant base broadening, but also there's a cyclical nature of corporate taxes, and therein lies volatility, which, of course, is dangerous for our economy. I fully share the view expressed by my colleague that the structural budget balance concept that was introduced last year, which we supported at the time, has indeed been visionary. As far as the more fundamental and sustainable change is concerned, BUSA is of the opinion that the reduction of the corporate tax rate by 1% this year was also fully justified because it was based on base broadening. And the principle that base broadening should always lead to tax relief remains a sound policy stance, even under the difficult circumstances that we're currently facing. Bruce, I wouldn't normally comment on personal tax, Chair, but of course our members, and particularly those who operate as sole proprietors and partnerships, are directly affected by the personal income tax regime in the country, and we therefore welcome the commitment, because it is a commitment in strong terms, in the medium-term budget policy statement that there will again be tax adjustments this year for personal income tax to cater for the effects of so-called fiscal drag. We would also like to urge, Chair, that this area, namely the area of personal taxation, is one area where the tax system can contribute significantly to one of the greatest economic challenges facing this country beyond unemployment, and that is our incredibly low levels of household savings. We do not see a compelling inducement. Those are words used by National Treasury in a past revenue laws amendment, in a budget review, a compelling inducement for people to provide for their old age and retirement through the tax system. We know that our system is under review, and we also can empathize with the view that one doesn't want to make haphazard changes, but we need something as a matter of urgency to get South Africans to save and to address one of our biggest economic problems, namely our challenge of savings, household savings particularly. Finally, a comment on VAT and poverty relief. BUSA welcomes the consistent stance that National Treasury has taken over the years to the very sensitive issue of extending the list of zero-rated items for value-added tax. The pressure from certain constituencies in this regard, Chair, is understandable, but in our research also has proven that it has quite often been misguided. And we commend National Treasury for being firm in this particular area. BUSA supports the view that direct public expenditure in the form of the grants, for example, can provide much more effective and targeted poverty relief. And we therefore welcome the adjustments to the grants, and particularly the bringing forward thereof. The numbers doesn't sound much, Chair, but the 20 Rand increase in the child grant is a 20% increase. And that is significant in the current environment, and BUSA recognizes that. Implementation of the 2008 tax proposals, we've already alluded to the fact that we are very supportive of the idea that this is part of the medium-term budget policy statement, a sort of stocktake of where we are, Chair, closes the loop in terms of the budget, the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, and the NTBPS in a very kind of comprehensive way, which GUSA is very supportive of, and particularly also the Business Parliamentary Office, because it gives us a kind of a stocktake that is very, very important also on the financial side. There are two things one thing that is new, namely the extension of the the effective date for the electricity levy to the 1st of July 2009. We unconditionally welcome that. And finally, we would just like to point out that the 5.6 billion rand, this is one of the issues that is on the agenda being implemented, the 5.6 billion rand allocated in the form of tax incentives to support government's industrial policy projects was something that we were ambivalent about. Members will recall that business, generally speaking, is of the view that it is better to have a lower tax environment rather than to have specific incentives, generally speaking. We have had confirmation of this also at a tax symposium earlier this year, which was called by National Treasury, addressed by inter alia the OECD, the IMF, and the World Bank, that tax incentives can be a very slippery slope. We would like to make one call at this stage, and it's a call on which our members, and particularly the Tax Committee, feels very strongly. And that is that the tax incentives under this program must, over the five-year period, be subject to detailed annual reporting to Parliament. Therein lies its possible salvation, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. There we have it, Fedusa and Busa. Members, Mr. Mlata again, Dr. George, Mr. Mngoni, Mr. Johnson. In that order, Mr. Mlata.
Thank you, Chair. I'm quite encouraged that Busa is making this point that very few people make about the Nigerian situation, and which I think to us underlines the vision that National Treasury had by coming with the structural balance. Because what's happened in Nigeria, clearly, people thought that the oil price would be at a certain level. And when that changes, then it presents major problems for your budget. Because if you have forecasted it that way, then you are locked up, you are locked into that system, and to reverse that would mean your expenditure patterns become very uncertain. And the other issue, which, I mean, I'm just complimenting you before asking questions. The other issue, which I think you're making available, that's my personal opinion, this one, about tax incentives. I agree with you. If these things are not well managed, one, you lose revenue, and towards the end, you realize you haven't achieved much. And I definitely agree with your view that some of these things, Parliament would have to get a detailed report on this thing. Just to establish the effectiveness of these tax incentives. And I agree with you that it's important to have, advisable to have a lower rate and have a lot of tax incentives all over, which are very difficult to manage at the end of the day. But now my first question to Busa would be the Harvard report. Indicates that part of our inability to grow the economy lies in the way it's structured, that it's not allowing competition. I just want to find out your views about that and whether a competition policy is managing to unlock those hindrances and bottlenecks so that small medium enterprises can be able to play a role. The second question, which is I think both to Fedusa and Busa, I just want to also to establish your opinion on the wage subsidy. Would that help in keeping unemployment, especially among the youth? And especially Busa, I would want to, I mean Fedusa, I want to hear the opinion of your members around this matter. Do they welcome it, or do they see it as a challenge to the security of employment of other workers?
Thank you, Chair. For Fedusa, I think we've all agreed that we're in the eye of an economic storm, and we're all in this thing together. So my question is, what is the trade union doing during this difficult time to assist the economy? That's it. And then for Busa, as you mentioned that South Africa is not attractive or not attractive enough for foreign investment, do you have any ideas what government could do to make it more attractive? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Mngoni.
Thanks, Chair. My first question is very similar to Dr. George's on to Fedusa. Busa has just said that the productivity and competitiveness is what we need to do in order to be successful. Now, what is Busa or Fedusa doing? What are that? How are you encouraging, or are you in any way encouraging your members to be more productive? Because one of the things that South Africa is not competitive is because of low productivity. What are you doing in that matter? And to Busa, the lady, you're saying that we need competitiveness and competitive economy in these times. Now, my question is, what do you think we could do best in this time? Because when you look at the phenomena or events that are happening, you've got an increasing budget, current account budget deficit, we are likely to see increasing interest rates. In order to stay on course, what do you think should be done? And last question on tax policy from Busa. You seem to be worried about the tax to GDP ratio. SARS is on the campaign to make more people to or more companies, small companies and big companies, to be tax liable. Now, in my view, the more you get companies paying their taxes, actually the more you can really lower the tax, but tax GDP ratio will increase as such. Why are you so worried about tax GDP ratio increases, whereas it can actually be lower? Companies might be paying less tax, but it might be more companies paying more tax, so that tax GDP ratio increases as such, but tax will be low. Why are you so worried about the tax GDP ratio? Thanks, Chair.
What next, Mr. Johnson?
Two quick ones, Chair. Thanks. The first one relates to the challenges that banks find themselves. We've had interventions in the U.S. and in Europe. We've also had our own experiences in the past with Future Bank and Sambo and some of those smaller banks. And at some point, there was some bit of shake-up even with NESCO, NetBank. What is your attitude towards what is referred to as a depositors insurance scheme? There has been such a discussion within Treasury. It hasn't gone that far. As a country, you might wish to say to your depositors, you are okay, you are safe, your money is in safe hands. So that's the first one, Chair. The second one, I read here in your presentation, Busa believes that prudent fiscal and monetary policy decisions have been okay. And again, everybody, or rather some people, they argue that you seriously need to revise, you know, your target bracket of our inflation, and perhaps your attitude in that direction as well. Thanks.
Okay, can we get responses? Perhaps in the same order that you presented, if we could start with FEDUSA and then take BUSA.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The question that I need to address is, first of all, the producer's opinion on the wage subsidy. Producer members, as members of trade union, are welcoming the wage subsidy. Concerns are raised, and those concerns, we're currently having bilaterals with the Minister of Finance to discuss detailed aspects of that, because obviously there would be sectors in your employment that might be vulnerable due to the wage subsidies. The exact how of the wage subsidies, how it will be implemented, the practicalities of that, the impact of that, etc., needs to be discussed. So we're having bilaterals with the Minister of Finance on the shortly, in the week, first week of November. And one of the issues that we're discussing with him is the wage subsidy. We would like to get more answers because there's a couple of questions. So that process is taking place, but overall producers welcome that. Then what is the trade union doing to assist the economy? Producers are quite heavily involved with the Department of Labor, the National Skills Fund, and the NSA on the current skills training program. We've got a training program where we're training artisans. This year we've trained 5,000 artisans where they were on learnership programs, technical artisans in various areas. They were employed in Transnet, private companies. They were employed in various sectors of the economy as artisans, and we're busy with that process. We've just signed another agreement with the Department of Labor where we intend to increase that amount to another 10,000 for next year, which is quite a huge amount, but it's various learnerships in various areas. So we're training, we're busy with training and development, skills training, practical training taking place. We've just finished our National Skills Fund training on Friday last week. We did a session across all 9 provinces, 3 sessions per province, where we were training 50 delegates per session, so it's 150 per province, to do skills training, very intensive skills training. We're taking this program forward after the 6th of November. Then are we encouraging our workers to be more productive? We're definitely doing that, because what's very important for us as producers currently is to retain your job. And workers in the country will not retain their jobs if they're not productive. We also don't want workers to be exploited. So we're fighting for labour rights, but at the same time, it's very important that employers know what their rights are, that workers know what their rights are, and then also what is your rights and your obligations. When you enter into a contract of employment, what do we need to do as workers? So for FEDUSA, we're constantly there educating and training our workers. We've run training courses this year with the CCMA, CCMA Commissioner training courses, where we've trained 120 CCMA commissioners, very advanced labour law training. Those commissioners are now going back into our respective trade unions. It might seem very small to you, but it's got a huge impact. Those 120 people are now going back into respective unions, and we are training our workers and educating them and ensuring that there is knowledge and that there is a realization that we're facing very tough times. And therefore, as workers, we also need to pull our part to bring the economy alive, to ensure that there's growth in the economy and that we're just not merely just making demands. But this is a time when we all should be rolling up our sleeves and say, what can we do together as employers and employees in the country? So there's definitely skills challenges, there's education programs taking place. We've really embarked on quite a well-advanced training program. If you would like to know more about that, on our website, www.fedusa.org.za, is quite a lot of information available on the various programs that we're running this year. Thank you. I hope that answered my question.
Did you see Mr. Rhodes' new incentive plan with regard to the incentives where it said work or get fired? Okay. Busa, your response.
Thank you, Chair. On the first question relating to the Harvard report, where the issue of competition in the South African economy was raised, I think as BUSA, we have supported the Competition Policy Amendment Bill, and we were involved closely with the DTI as well as the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry in the amendment of the competition law in South Africa. But I think, you know, as far as competition is concerned, we must also bear in mind that our pattern of industrialization really reflects the size of our market and also the historical patterns in South Africa. It is not always the case that the reason we do not have higher levels of competition is because business is doing something wrong. Sometimes it is because of the preferred risk by international investors, which is why when you look at competition and levels of concentration in our economy, we must also look at issues of competitiveness and productivity. We are a small economy. We are a small market. So if you want international companies to invest in South Africa, therefore, increasing the levels of competition in our local economy, we must ensure that the domestic environment is also suitable, which is what my colleague was referring to earlier on as well. The second question was on productivity and competitiveness. If I recall correctly, the question is how do you increase productivity and competitiveness in the current environment? I think it is important for us to look at productivity and competitiveness as a long-term objective and a long-term exercise. Therefore, despite the current challenges which the entire global economy finds itself, we must now say, where do we want to be in 10 years? What sort of workers do we want to have? What sort of industries do we want to have in this economy? And invest aggressively in those. For example, investment in human capital has to be a critical part of this. The previous panelists referred to the fact that despite our substantial investments in education and health, we're not getting the desired outputs. Now, as South Africans, we have to take that seriously and say, how do we increase productivity in government spending? Because it is not enough for us to call for more allocations if there is no output. And I think for me, that is one of the issues and areas where we need to focus on as a long-term exercise. We cannot look at competitiveness as a short-term goal. Because in actual fact, competitiveness is a set of policies, institutions, regulations, as well as skills and resources within your economy that help you perform optimally and increase your economic growth. I'm not sure if that does answer the question, but I think let's take a long-term view. Let us not get confused by the current turmoil, and let's take our eyes on the goal, which is obviously increasing economic growth. The third question was relating to the issue of the challenges that banks find themselves in the current financial crisis. The issue of deposits insurance is very, very important, and I think as South Africans, we have to ask ourselves these questions. Certainly, theory tells us that deposit insurance does help avert bank runs. As we saw in the UK, bank runs led to the collapse of Northern Rock. But what we have to ask ourselves is how do we finance such a deposit insurance scheme? And there are fiscal questions that have to be asked, and therefore, the suggestions earlier on by the chair that we should have a day where we actually ask those questions is very, very important. Because the issue of bank regulation and supervision, which includes deposit insurance questions, must be viewed holistically. So we must look at the role of supervisors, the role of deposit insurance, the role of the banks, and how those are interlinked. And what does it mean going forward? I think it's also interesting to know that we're hearing every day about the proposed international summit, which will discuss the financial framework for regulation of banks and financial services internationally. It might also be opportune for us as South Africans to start our own debate in anticipation of developments from there, because we don't want to be caught off guard where the global leaders might have made some decisions without us having made our own internal choices as well. And finally, the last question was on the issue of prudent fiscal and monetary policy statements that we made in our document. Honourable members, I think in our view as BUSA, price stability is the necessary precursor to economic growth. And so for us as BUSA, we have supported inflation targeting. We remain supportive of inflation targeting regime, and despite the current challenges and the difficulties which most of us find ourselves in, we believe it is a prudent policy directive taken by this government. And if there are questions around that, I think it's important for us to invest the necessary intellectual capital and to ensure that our reactions are not knee-jerk, but also are based on the long-term view of where we want to take this country. Thank you.
Then there was a question whether the increase in the tax to GDP ratio is not a function of the closing of the tax gap and tax compliance.
Okay, I'll deal with the tax questions. I mean, firstly, the tax to GDP ratio. First, let me say categorically that Buza is not worried about the tax to GDP ratio, but it is something that is of critical importance if one wants to overall evaluate the sentiments as to whether a particular country is overtaxed. There's a deep realization in Buza that our tax to GDP ratio has increased precisely for the reasons that the Honorable Member has mentioned, namely that there's been base broadening, more and more companies being brought into the net. The net is, of course, not infinite. We have been taking up slack, and it is our whole point that at this stage, perhaps some of that slack is beginning to fall away, and that we have now deeply entrenched into our system better tax administration and a broadening of the tax base. And in those circumstances, one would like to see a stabilization of the tax to GDP ratio, as is foreseen in this medium-term budget policy statement, which we welcome. We would be concerned if the, I think as it is worded, and let me use the correct wording, if the further tax instruments to fund local governments that are being investigated means additional taxes and not the replacement of existing taxes in a more efficient way. That would concern us because that would be a blatant increase then if the tax to GDP ratio and the tax environment in general will become less attractive, which brings me to the second question, namely why this country is not attractive for foreign direct investment and what we would suggest should be done. Our suggestion at this stage is that one should also deeply look at even the tax environment, and tax competitiveness is part of that overall country competitiveness. The OECD has just released a paper earlier this year that clearly says tax is not the only thing. It is not the main determinant, this paper says, released in March this year. FDI is attracted to countries offering access to markets and profit opportunities. Do we have those? A predictable and non-discriminatory legal and regulatory framework, in short, the rule of law, certainly we can tick that one. Macroeconomic stability, we can tick that one. Skilled and responsive labor markets, maybe a question mark. And developed infrastructure, and we would like to add, developed and well-maintained infrastructure. Those are the issues that are more important than tax. That's recognized. But I can't help thinking, Chair, that when I sit at international tax conferences, as I've done for the past two decades, and I look at my colleagues from small countries, and one's talking about Malta and Poland and this year Cyprus, for example, where the conference was, that one of the first issues on the agenda is to see how the tax system of those countries can be conducive to attract foreign direct investors, not to put their money there, but to build their factories there and to export from those shores. If you look at our record in that regard, Chair, it is not a rosy picture, as was pointed out earlier this day today by The Economist. Finally, there's the question on Buza's view on the wage subsidy. A difficult one. I think the jury is out on that. The wage subsidy can mean quite a few things. As Dr. George will know, a wage subsidy has been proposed by the DA some time back, which varies quite a lot from the wage subsidy that, for example, is currently being discussed in the Social Security and Retirement Fund reform context. The Buza view that is very clear and which is developing from the discussions around Social Security and Retirement Fund reform is that if we are going to have compulsory contributions by business to a national Social Security fund, those would have to be offset by a wage subsidy to avoid a very, very negative reaction on employment.
Thank you very much. That then brings us to the end of this session. And thanks very much for appearing before us. I know the time was not adequate. I've indicated that. We trust that in future there will be adequate time to engage with these issues. It's important that we do. But thanks very much for coming before the committee. And members, we... I'm going to